The third time that the program has put on a State of the Bay conference. We do this about every 3 years. There's two purposes, really. The first is to report on the progress or changes in environmental indicators on the health of the Bay. And the other has been to present research that's been going on over the last few years, as well as other programs and projects that we think might be interesting to the community at large. The Morro Bay, well, let me explain who I am first. My name is Michael Moltari. I am the interim director of the program. Dan Berman, who was the director for the last few years and did a very fine job as the leader of the program, did take another job recently, but I did want to mention him and thank him, even though he's not here, for the leadership in their efforts to improve the Bay ecology and the watershed health. It is funded in part by the United States Environmental Protection Agency, and we really appreciate the funding that they provide to us. Without it, we wouldn't be able to have the staff and offices and programs that we do. The way that the National Estuary Program is organized in Morro Bay is somewhat unusual. We have what's called an implementation committee, which is made up of representatives of various interests throughout the watershed and along the bay, and also invites citizens to come and participate in those meetings. They meet quarterly and talk about some of the issues of the day. There's also an executive committee which actually makes the decisions about policies and how the money should be spent. And then it's overseen entirely by the Bay Foundation, which is a nonprofit corporation, which is responsible for the fiduciary and management obligations of the program, and as entirely volunteer members who make that. And some of the Bay Foundation folks are here this morning. You may be embarrassed, but at least raise your hands, guys. Thank you. They do a great job. In addition, we have volunteer monitoring programs and other volunteer programs, so that a lot of the work that's being done in the watershed are by folks that just give their time and interest to the benefit of the Bay. Lastly, I would like to thank the staff who worked very hard to put this together, and particularly Cynthia Milham, who's not in the room, but she was very instrumental in getting the logistics set up, and she's walking in the back doing her usual job of keeping everything organized, but particularly Sherry Sullivan, who is not in the room, but I'm sure most of you have seen her around. Sherry is really responsible for all of this organization and this program that we've had over the last 2 days. There she is. Thank you very much. And now I'd like to introduce our district supervisor, county supervisor, Bruce Gibson, who would like to welcome you to the program. We very much appreciate the work that he's done on behalf of Morro Bay and the estuary, and we're glad that he's here this morning. Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you, Michael, and thank all of you for coming out on this slightly gloomy as of yet Saturday morning. You know, I consider myself the luckiest elected official in California. I was and seeing things thrive, and when we look at views of our county, there are a few iconic images. One of them really is the view of Morro Bay and the rock, the estuary, the valleys that lead into it. And it's been a tremendous pleasure for me to see the evolution of the National Estuary Program. That started not long after I first moved here in the late 80s. And as with everything in this county, an extraordinary program. It's an extraordinary estuary. It happens to be the smallest of the national estuaries in the program. Through the previous director, Dan Berman, I got to participate in some of them, some of the wider national scale meetings of national estuaries. And this is unique, by far the smallest. And yet at the same time, it has the full range of, you know, glorious ecology, interesting bits of science, and significant challenges that every other estuary has. And so I think your gathering here is very much in line with the approach, the promise, the potential of the National Estuary Program because of its scale. I've often said this county is the perfect place to do politics, the perfect place to be in public service because of the scale. We are large enough that we have remarkable individuals working for our agencies, for our county government, for our agencies such as the National Estuary Program. And yet we're small enough to be personal. So people can get personally involved in that. And your presence here to me is just another example of that personal involvement. And it is the people who live closest to these special places who care the most about them. And as I looked over yesterday's program, which I'm sorry that I was not able to attend, I kept seeing the word collaboration as we talked about our fisheries, as we talked today about the health of the bay and some of the challenges in front of us. We're going to be talking about ways in which a wide variety of individuals will participate to take on these challenges. The watershed here stretches all the way to the outskirts of San Luis Obispo. It includes folks of a diverse range of backgrounds, interests, and lifestyles.
Well, thank you, Bruce. All right, as you mentioned, in conjunction with the State of the Bay Conference, the Estuary Program puts together a report card. It's been right out front. This is the full 24-page copy that we have. We also produced a summary card that's out front as well. It's basically a snapshot of the health of the bay. So next, what we want to do is have a couple of staff members very briefly present the information in this publication and go over some of the details a little bit. We'll start with Ann Kitajima, who manages the monitoring program for the Estuary Program, and we'll follow by with John Hall, who's the restoration coordinator. I just left you that PowerPoint.
Good morning, everyone. I hate podiums. You can see why. And on top of that, there's this laptop here. So for all you over there, I'm just a disembodied voice, and I apologize. Okay, so I'm going to talk to you today about 5 of the 8 indicators that we covered in our Estuary Tidings environmental report card. We first put together this report card in 2006. In order to compile this report card, it was not an effort by the Estuary Program alone. We had a technical advisory committee made up of participants from local agencies, local government, private citizens, who all came together to help us determine which indicators would best describe the health of the estuary and the watershed, and help us decide which data to include. And then when it came time to update that report card for 2010, we again pulled together a group, a technical advisory committee. So this document, I just want everyone to understand, was a very collaborative effort. I think the Estuary Program, we felt more like we were kind of a clearinghouse for the data. It's not all our data. Some of it's ours, but it comes from many other partners in the watershed as well. And then in particular, I want to recognize a few. The American Reinvestment and Recovery Act is helping to fund the monitoring program and the work that we do right now, so I wanted to recognize that. The area of land that drains into the bay. And also, I need, before I start, to give a big thank you to the program's volunteers. We have about 50 volunteers that pass through our doors each year, contributing a total of usually about 1,200 hours a year, and they do really good work. They collect high-quality data that's used not just by the Estuary Program, but by local regulatory agencies as well. So I just want to give a special thank you. A good deal of the data that you're going to see today was collected by the volunteers. Okay, so our first topic is shellfish harvesting. Is the bay clean enough to support commercial shellfish harvesting? And the answer is yes, in the designated operating harvest areas. And we do have two operating shellfish farms in the bay, the Morro Bay Oyster Company and the Grassy Bar Oyster Company. As you can imagine, the shellfish farms are pretty strictly regulated by the California Department of Public Health. Once the shellfish are harvested, they're the responsibility of the Food and Drug Administration. But in the pre-harvest stage, it's the California Department of Public Health who's responsible. The farmers collect water samples on a weekly basis that are tested for fecal coliform. And as you can imagine, the water quality regulations are a lot stricter for shellfish-growing waters than they are for swimming. Shellfish are filter feeders, so obviously they need to be grown in clean water in order to be safe for us to eat. So these parcels, this map shows the growing area leases that are managed by Fish and Game. The crosshatch areas show the areas that are currently closed for harvesting, and the green shows the areas that are open for harvesting. Each area in the parcel is classified either as prohibited or conditionally approved. Prohibited means that their farmers are not allowed to grow shellfish in that area, either because there's a history of poor water quality or because there just isn't any data from that part of the parcel. It could be a part of the farm that they just don't want to use at this time. And then the second status, conditionally approved, means that the water quality results that they're getting show that the water is clean enough for shellfish harvesting. But even in a conditionally approved area, those areas can occasionally be temporarily closed for various reasons. Rainfall is a common one. If it rains more than 0.4 inches in 24 hours, they have to shut down for a certain amount of time due to urban runoff and ag runoff. Toxic plankton blooms can also negatively affect the shellfish since, again, they're filter feeders. Your black line shows, it's kind of an average, a compilation of the data. And as you can see, over time, that black line has stayed below the red line. And in times when those two lines are coming too close together, the regulatory agency may make some changes, like, for instance, have a slightly longer closure period following a rainfall so that they can ensure that the water quality is high enough for harvesting. So in conclusion, I just want everyone to, feel comfortable that the growing waters are very strictly regulated. And we should be proud of the fact that the water quality we have here is clean enough to support a shellfish operation. There are only a few areas in the state where shellfish can be grown where the waters are clean enough. So I think that we should be quite proud of that fact. It says that we have a healthy ecosystem. Okay, the next indicator question involves safe swimming. What we're looking at here is bacteria levels in the bay and the creeks. So we had two questions here. One was, is Morro Bay safe for swimming? And the answer is yes, in most areas. And then the second question is, are the creeks safe for recreational contact? And the answer there was not consistently. So pathogen, that term refers to bacteria, viruses, protozoa that can make us ill. As you can imagine, they come from a number of sources, so this graph just shows what some of them are. The thing about the bacteria testing we do, we cannot tell from the results which of these was the source of the bacteria. All our tests show is that there is a sign that there was fecal contamination in the water. The indicator species that we monitor in freshwater in the creek systems, it's total coliform and E. coli. And in the marine systems in the bay, it's E. coli and Enterococcus. And there's one of our volunteers, Karen, in the lab running the samples. Here's a map of the watershed showing some of our results. We monitor a total of 15 sites on a monthly basis, and we picked out 9 of them to show you here. The dots and the little percent numbers show the percent of samples that exceeded the bacteria level for safe swimming. And so, as you can see, we don't unfortunately have any green dots. Those are the good ones that show the water's clean most of the time. And what really stands out is that 84% number on San Lucido Creek. That means of all the samples we collected, 84% of the time the water was unsafe for swimming. So if we look more in detail at the data from that site on San Lucido Creek, that red line represents the regulatory limit for safe swimming, and the black shows a trend line. The Resource Conservation District and NRCS to work with this private landowner to put up riparian fencing that keeps cattle out of the creek and installed water troughs so the cattle still have something to drink. And then program volunteers, our volunteers are continuing to do bacteria monitoring. The project was completed in early 2009, so we're kind of waiting to see the results, but immediately we saw a reduction in bacteria. Okay, so switching to the Bay, the dots represent our monitoring sites, and the percentages show the percent of samples that exceeded the safe swimming levels. And the Bay is a much happier picture, particularly all the front Bay sites, Coleman, Tideland Park, Windy Cove, and State Park Marina rarely have exceedances. Same with back in the Bay at Cuesta Inlet. But Pasadena Point and Baywood Pier have periodic exceedances of levels that are safe for swimming. Here's a detailed plot of the data from Baywood Pier. Again, that red line is the regulatory limit, and the black line shows the trend line. There appears to be an improvement in that trend. That line's sort of dropping, so as we add more data, we'll be interested to see how the trend continues. You might have noticed those signs posted next to Baywood Pier. I believe there's one at Pasadena Point also advising against swimming or ingesting the water there. And those signs were posted in part due to the data that our program collected. So in conclusion, most people don't swim in the creeks, obviously. Most of the recreational contact is in the Bay, and most of the time it is safe to swim in the Bay. But like all other areas, you should stay out of the water for 3 days following a storm. When rain falls, it's washing a lot of pollution. It goes straight into the Bay untreated, and so typically it's not a good idea to go swimming immediately after a storm. All right, aquatic life. So the question was, does water quality in creeks and bays support fish and aquatic life? And our answer was yes. Habitats are healthy in most areas, but some are degrading. This aquatic life question is actually very complex. It really depends on what parameters you decide to look at. We chose to look at macroinvertebrates and dissolved oxygen in the Bay, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the others that we considered. So macroinvertebrates are animals that have no backbone that are visible to the naked eye. Some of them are very sensitive to pollution. They need cold, clean, pollution-free water in order to live. And then there are other macroinvertebrates that could live in any kind of water. It doesn't matter. So it's a single number called the Index of Biological Integrity. And what it does, it just takes a lot of different bug numbers and metrics and lets you have one number from your site so you can easily compare it to other sites. And so looking at, this is, I believe, the data from 2008. That orange dot there is our worst site, got a poor rating. That's on Choro Ecological Reserve. That site is downstream from the wastewater treatment plant that the Men's Colony operates. That earlier that year, right before we sampled, they had a number of chlorine exceedances, not necessarily spilled, catastrophic spills, but they were discharging higher chlorine levels than their permits allowed. And we think that that's the reason for such poor numbers at that site. But overall, in the watershed, things are looking pretty good. We had 5 sites get a fair rating, 3 good, and 1 excellent. That very good score, the dark green, is way up on Dairy Creek, right on Camp San Luis property. Okay, so switching to the Bay, we looked at dissolved oxygen levels in the Bay. We have a troop of volunteers called the Dawn Patrol, and they go out kayaking in the early morning hours, usually right around sunrise, and they collect oxygen readings from around the Bay. And so we plotted their numbers. We wanted to cover a broader time frame, so we just plotted every other year. But the color represents the dissolved oxygen levels, so the dark green being the very best, the lighter green being good, and yellow being fair. And so all through the front Bay sites, we're seeing very good or good dissolved oxygen levels. But in the sites more towards the back, Cuesta Inlet and Sharks Inlet are really receiving mostly only fair ratings. This is likely due, anyone who's been out there paddling and knows there isn't a lot of tidal flushing going on in the Back Bay, and that's probably the reason for these numbers. So in conclusion, we've got pretty healthy macroinvertebrate populations from throughout our watershed. We do have some challenges at some of the sites with nutrient enrichment, particularly the ones downstream from the Men's Colony wastewater treatment plant outfall. There are some elevated nutrient levels there that are potentially of concern. And in the Bay, we have acceptable to excellent dissolved oxygen levels. And we're very lucky. You hear about areas like in the Gulf that have these dead zones that appear in the summer, and then it's just you know, everything dies in a huge areas, you know, nothing like that here. I did want to mention, though, a potential threat, the issue of emerging contaminants. We had a talk yesterday, but it's probably going to be a big issue in the future. Okay, eelgrass. Morro Bay has some of the last remaining healthy eelgrass in Southern California. So anyone who's been out there paddling, I'm sure, has seen it. On a low tide, it looks just, it flattens out. But it, when it's submerged, these are long blades of grass that float up, and they provide what we consider to be a very valuable habitat because it provides food, shelter, and protection from predators for marine life. So we consider that to be a habitat that we want to preserve and encourage in the bay. A lot, like I said, a lot of things live in the eelgrass, and we've been fortunate. And it's really interesting work because you're never quite sure what you're going to see when you're out there. So these are some of the things we've seen when we've been out monitoring. We conduct bay-wide eelgrass maps, usually every other year or so. The way this works is we have an aerial flight flown. They collect imagery of the bay. Each type of marine vegetation gives off a unique signature. And so by picking out the eelgrass signature, we can create a map of where the eelgrass is located in the bay. So this map was from fall 07. The flight happens on a negative tide in the fall. Looking at acreage of eelgrass over time, the early data from 1960 and 1972 were collected by Fish and Game. I think it was a guy in a small plane with a notebook drawing in where the eelgrass was. From 1988 to 1998, a local biologist named John Chesnut created the maps. I think mostly he used aerial photos, and then he just did a lot of kayaking to ground truth the images. And then starting in 2002, this data has been collected by the estuary program. So you might notice there's a rather precipitous drop in eelgrass acreage between 94 and 95. Those of you who've lived here for a while may remember the Highway 41 fire and then the heavy El Nino rains that followed the year after. So those brought a good deal of sediment down, you know, through the creeks and dumping it into the bay. That ended up smothering a great deal of the eelgrass. And the eelgrass, it's taken a while, but it appears to be making a comeback. We're seeing increases each year. The other thing we wanted to do with the data is focus more tightly in a few specific areas to see if we could track changes more in individual beds. So looking, this is a state park marine area, you can kind of see. The eelgrass monitoring, in addition to the aerial flight, the other thing we do, we have four permanent transects located throughout the bay. We go out with a long tape measure and a 1 meter square quadrat, and we count shoot densities at these established transects. And then we also collect eelgrass and dry it and weigh it and do biomass measurements. And we've got a poster on the other side there that talks about that transect and biomass work. So in conclusion, as we continue to study eelgrass, we're finding that it's quite a dynamic and complex system. And that, as I mentioned, eelgrass is greatly impacted by water clarity, as we saw in the 1994 to 95 die-off of eelgrass. As you know, this was a much heavier than normal rain year. And so although we would have normally skipped the monitoring for this fall coming up, I believe we're going to conduct mapping this fall because we're expecting to see some negative impacts due to the heavier than normal rains. Okay, bird populations. So the question was, are the bird populations that depend on the bay habitat stable? Answer we found was yes, most populations appear relatively stable over the past 15 years. However, brant and snowy plover require continued monitoring. So with the shorebird surveying, we have some local volunteers who come out each fall. They conduct a two-hour survey. Surveyors spread out over the bay, the sand spit, and the strand, and conduct counts during a two-hour period. Numbers are relatively stable from year to year, and also quite important, the diversity seems to be staying relatively stable with an average of 21 species seen each year. Snowy plover are a small shorebird that nests directly on the beach. state parks. This is state parks data. They've been conducting a good deal of monitoring each season. And so what we have graphed here, the blue shows the total number of nests, and the green shows the number of those nests that hatched. You can see 04 was a relatively successful year. They credited that to El Nino rains. And 07 was a particularly difficult year for plover. Half of the nests were lost to predation was what the plover monitors found. Plovers face a number of challenges, natural challenges. A strong tidal surge can wipe out their nests, strong wind here and spend the winter here in Morro Bay. They eat eelgrass, so you could see why Morro Bay would be a great place for them to hang out and refuel. The early data here, 1931 to 42, was collected by a private citizen who was very interested in the brant, and so he would drive up and down the coast and do counts. The 1950 to 66 data was collected by Fish and Game, and then all data since then has been collected by John Roser, who's a local biologist. And so you could see the brant numbers are coming down. The reasons for this are manifold, and it's not just an indicator for Morro Bay, it's also looking at broader issues all up and down the flyway. But I think that this emphasizes that, you know, Morro Bay needs to try to continue to be a brant-friendly location, because there really aren't many areas in Southern California for brant. So in conclusion, like I said, Morro Bay, we provide very important bird habitat, as many of you know, and so it's important for us to maintain that habitat. And it emphasizes a need for protection and preservation in Morro Bay. Okay, so those were the five I was going to cover. John Hall, our restoration coordinator, will now be talking about the last three indicators. Thanks.
All right, let's see. So as Ann told you, healthy habitats are very important for our fish and wildlife, and they're also healthy or important for water quality and for our natural beauty and character of this area. And so the question that we wanted to answer was, are these important habitats being protected? We have a number of approaches that we do to protect these habitats. We have conservation agreements, land acquisitions, restoration projects, and enhancement projects. So conservation agreements, these are sometimes termed conservation easements, and this is a legal agreement between a landowner and a conservation organization where you limit the uses of the land to help protect a conservation priority. And so this map that you're looking at, what we tried to do is capture all of the efforts that are going on in the watershed. And so as you're looking at it, what you're seeing is not just purchase these pieces of land and protect them in perpetuity. Restoration projects, these in some instances the habitat gets severely degraded by humans, and in those cases, it takes significant resources to try and bring them back up to native conditions, and that's what a restoration project is. But an enhancement project, you know, in some cases, we can see habitat that is becoming degraded, but if we act quickly, it takes a lot less resources to bring it back to a native condition, and we call that enhancement. And so, as you can see from this map, you know, the answer to our question is yes, important habitats are being protected, and this work is ongoing. So every year, this map gets bigger and bigger. So the next indicator that I'd like to talk about is a priority problem for the estuary program, and the question is the bay filling in? And to get at this question, what we did is we, I don't know how well you guys can see this image, but what we did is we wanted to measure the extent of the salt marsh. And so we looked at this image right here, this polygon, and that was taken off a 1988 USGS T-sheet. And that's our earliest image of what the estuary actually looked like. And this next polygon was taking off an aerial photo in 1937. So this is 56 years later, and in 56 years, we almost doubled the size of the salt marsh. And then what you're seeing with these two polygons here, this is the last 71 years. And so what you can see, which is pretty interesting, is that in the last 71 years, there's been a lot less expansion of the salt marsh than there was in the first 56 years. And this is actually what we expect to see, because in natural estuaries, as they're young and they have a lot of space for new sediment, they fill in a lot faster as they're younger. And as they start getting older, the rate that they fill in actually slows down. It's at a nonlinear rate. But studies from the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Soil Conservation Service are still telling us that 50% of the sediment coming downstream is from development and agriculture, so from non-natural sources. And so even though the rate is this watershed. And so we've expended a significant amount of resources trying to identify and correct some of these sources of erosion. But doing that isn't enough. You know, another approach that we have is trying to catch this sediment before it enters the bay. And so, you know, in a natural system, as these waters are kind of up in the steeper parts of the watershed, as they come down close to the estuary, the gradient changes and you have floodplains. And so during periods of high flow, these flows expand out onto the floodplains and the sediment gets captured. And, you know, what happened here, which is what happens in a lot of places, is these floodplain areas actually have really good soil for agriculture. And so we levied up those floodplains for agriculture, and that's some of our most productive ag land here. And so what's been happening is, you know, a lot of work has gone into acquiring areas like the Chora Flats area and restoring these historic floodplains so that we have that sediment capture again. And then the third option, you know, that a lot of people were talking about was removing sediment from the bay. You know, if the bay is filling in, we should just remove the sediment. And so they actually investigated that, and unfortunately, economically, it's not very feasible. The price tag on it, I think, was $70 million. And ecologically, it's not very feasible because, you know, as the bay starts filling in, it's actually different habits. It's converting to different habitat types. And so it gets shallower and it starts turning into mudflats, which are very important for birds and very healthy. And then as it gets even shallower than that, it starts converting to these salt marshes. And those are both really rare and valuable habitats. And so it wouldn't be feasible to go in and then just dig those out because we wanted, you know, to have more eelgrass beds. So the answer to our question is, you know, it is still filling in, you know, faster than we would like. But a lot of good work has been done towards this effort, and I think that in the future we're going to start seeing the benefits from that. And our last indicator of estuary health is healthy steelhead populations. And what we wanted to know is, does the estuary and watershed support a healthy population of steelhead trout? And what we would like to do is measure the populations of steelhead, and unfortunately, we don't have good enough data to show. Went through all of these streams in our watershed, broke them into reaches, and assessed each one of those reaches for habitat quality and how that relates to steelhead. And specifically, what they were looking at is water flow, the amount of water that is coming through these systems, water quality, in-stream habitat, riparian habitat, and impacts from exotic species. And the results of what they came up with is depicted in this map. And so as you're looking at this, what you're seeing is the dark green areas. This represents the best habitat we have for steelhead. Light green is fair habitat, and yellow areas are impaired habitat for different reasons, and the red is degraded habitat. And then the blue areas that you see are areas where we actually didn't have enough data to to make a good assessment, and so we just recognize those as data that are lacking or areas that are lacking data. And then another thing to look at on this map are these fish with circles around them. What those represent are migration barriers for fish. So first, one reason or another, they're either full barriers or partial barriers, but each one of these locations, there's something there that's limiting fish's access to those habitats. And so what we can see from this is that there is a lot of good habitat in our watershed that has limited access or no access for the steelhead trout. And another thing that we found while we were doing this is that one of the biggest limiting factors for steelhead trout here was water flow. And in the future, this is going to become a bigger and bigger problem because with climate change and an increasing population, our demands on water are becoming greater. And as we do that, sometimes it can be at the expense of other organisms like steelhead trout. And so, the answer to the question is, we do have a lot of good habitat for steelhead trout. We do have a sustaining population, but like everywhere else in California, our populations are on the decline. And there is still a lot of data that we don't know. There's a lot of these areas, like Warden Creek, where we just don't have enough data to make an assessment.
All right, so after that, we're moving into climate change. And to speak on that topic, we have Adrian Grieve, who's the Assistant Professor of City and Regional Planning at Cal Poly. Let me pull up her.
So this is going to be that third category of presentation that Mike talked about in the beginning that isn't necessarily specific research on the Bay, but hopefully something that will be interesting to many of you. And the reason I think it's appropriate now is particularly for this conference is that in this county and in the municipalities in the county, this is an issue that's going to be central to city planning in the next few years. The county itself is kicking off its climate planning process. They've completed an inventory, and each of the cities is at a different phase in that process. So my aim today is to talk a little bit about what is climate planning, what are the things that are involved in doing or constructing policy about climate change, and also what are some of the issues that you should think about as you watch your community go through this. So that said, I'm not a climate scientist. I'm not going to be covering kind of the science and the reasoning behind climate change. My intent today is really about what's the response to it. So this is the one and only picture you'll see that's about what is global warming. I think we've been hearing about it in the national news enough that I'm not going to spend time today on that. There's greenhouse gases. I will use that term. That's keeping more heat than had been historically kept in, so the planet is warming. The science isn't definitive in some areas, it's more definitive in others. We are getting warmer. That is less debated today. Why? There's some more argument about why. In terms of spatially specific, what does that mean for local areas? That's really uncertain as yet. And that poses a challenge for doing something about it. And so that's a little bit of what I'll be talking about. So for today, you can see that a good portion of the United States have state policy around climate change. So state, a CAP is a climate action plan. So this is as of November of last year. And as you watch, there's a set of federal bills working their way through Congress right now. As you see that happening, I think we'll end up seeing this map be completely green through time. The same way you see states enacting hazard plans, for example. Well, the federal government tied completing a hazard plan to being eligible for federal disaster relief. that strong motivation for enacting these policies. I think we may start to see federal mandate for state-level action. That said, cities have been doing this a lot longer than the states. This is a map of the over 1,000 cities that have signed on to the mayor's climate agreement. This was an agreement started by Seattle's Mayor Nichols, and it matches the Kyoto Protocol goals. It was recognizing that while our federal government didn't sign on to the Kyoto Protocol, there's no reason cities couldn't take action. And as you can see, every state in the country has at least one city. Many states have more. What you also start to recognize, and researchers have found, is that it's not necessarily your big cities or liberal college towns that have been doing this. One of the best predictors of whether or not a city has enacted climate-related policy is whether or not that city is vulnerable to climate impacts. So are you prone to flooding, sea level rise, extreme heat, drought? That's a very good predictor about whether or not a city has started to enact policy. For example, there's a lot of cities in Florida. Sea level rise poses a tremendous threat to Florida. So that's part of what's driving taking action. That said, you can sign on, but not a lot of cities have actually adopted a climate plan as a freestanding piece of policy. So as of October of last year, right around 70 in the whole country actually had adopted plans. When I say California's leading the way, a majority, if you look at the states, California has. And when I said it's not necessarily the stereotypical cities that have done this, included in this pie chart, you have Homer, Alaska, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a Rust Belt city. So you do see it's not just this identity of these very liberal, kind of the Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, Berkeleys of the world. There are a good number of cities nationally that are doing this, and there's hundreds more in development. It's called the Global Warming Solutions Act. And if you read the letter of the law, it talks about fixed site polluters and state goals with suggesting local action. Well, there are two settlements that have meant it's a lot more far-reaching than it has been historically, or at least by the letter of AB 32, San Bernardino and Stockton. So San Bernardino adopted a general plan that had a lot of new growth. The attorney general stepped in and said, you have a lot of new growth that's going to result in a lot more driving, but you haven't mitigated climate change-related gases or greenhouse gases. You need to somehow fix that. And in a settlement, it went to lawsuit. He asked San Bernardino to inventory greenhouse gases and write a local plan. Through that process, we now have policy through another bill at the state level that includes greenhouse gases in CEQA, or the California Environmental Quality Act, meaning every general plan, every new proposed project has to mitigate greenhouse gases, meaning it's now a mandate in the state. So you're seeing many cities in California create climate plans out of necessity, because for projects to be built in your city, they need guidance on how to deal with climate change because it's now state law under CEQA. And you have to go through CEQA when you update your general plan, meaning cities now, either through integrating it into a general plan or through a freestanding plan or climate plan, you need to deal with climate change. SB 375 is up there, partly because it's the new bill. It's a regional bill that's looking for transportation, and you'll see there's a bunch of different lingos, but it's after land use and transportation, aiming for sustainability, and this is recognizing that in California, greenhouse gases come from driving, and driving is very related to our transportation network, but also the distribution of land use. If you live nearer to where you work and nearer to where your children go to school, nearer to where you buy groceries and seek entertainment, you're going to drive a lot less. And so this is recognizing that relationship. I would keep your eyes open this summer in late August. We should start to see some of the plans, policies, and allocation of your responsibility for mitigating climate change being handed out on the regional level by municipal planning organizations. So as community members, as you watch these policy come down, that will be happening in late summer. If it gets delayed, gases hang out in the atmosphere for a very long time, meaning there are some changes we can't stop. So we need to actually have plans in place for what do we do in the event of sea level rise, extreme heat, which is a very different kind of planning. That's termed adaptation. This is where you start getting into a language issue with planning. Adapting to climate impacts, it's sort of the same thing as mitigating natural hazards. And we've been doing that for a long time. We have safety elements in our general plans for our cities. We have hazard plans. Any of those that mitigate flooding, higher tides, storm surges, forest fires, that's natural hazards. Well, those are also climate impacts. And so when you look at a hazard profile for the state, I've highlighted some of those that are associated with climate change. So increased flooding, sea level rise, drought, extreme heat, severe weather, certainly up in the Delta area, levee failure is a very scary prospect for statewide drinking water and for safety for the statewide. Secondary impacts can also include economic impacts because of impact to our agricultural economy in terms of agricultural practices from lack of water to changing temperature profiles, meaning you'll need to adapt and maybe anticipate some of those impacts moving forward. We do have strategies for doing this, and so I'm going to start with adaptation and finish with mitigation, giving you some ideas. So when you think about these, the state has kind of tried to narrow it, and what I would want to point out, the science on this, it's uncertain. You can't definitively say Morro Bay, you will see this many inches of sea level rise. We just don't know. There are large amounts of error bars. We know it will rise. We don't really know how much as yet. We know it's likely to get warmer. We're likely to see some drought. We just don't know how much. And similar with secondary impacts, a forest fire. It's more likely that you can't definitively say it will happen when. So this is trying to enact policy in the face of extreme uncertainty. So this is three scenarios that the state has run. It's built off international scenarios. In terms of what does it mean here, what I would want to point out is that they have done a best-case scenario to worst-case scenario, and in the next 20 to 30 years, they all look the same. So when I say there's unavoidable impacts, this altering our driving patterns, altering the way we get our energy, that's when you can really start to have impacts on what's going to happen. So that's the mitigation piece. All right, so adapting. Adapting isn't all that simple. The first task is to assess the potential risk. And this differs for everybody. And remember, this is regional science that isn't very spatially specific. Is identifying for your jurisdiction, what are the things we're going to have to think about a little more? And then how do you act? How do you decide what to do? You can act directly. If you're afraid of sea level rise, does that mean armoring your banks and building levees? Or indirectly? Indirectly can be acting economically or politically. So perhaps in the agricultural regions, acting indirectly might be encouraging shift to different crop types that are better adapted to different temperature or water regimes, for example. And then deciding, should you be retreating, resisting, or resilience, which are three different types of policy in response to climate change. So retreat would be recognizing sea level rise and slowly, through land use planning, moving back and recognizing that, you know what, perhaps we shouldn't place infrastructure, homes, roads, water treatment plants in areas that may be inundated with water. That would be strategic retreat. Resist, that's armoring. That's saying, okay, rise, we'll stop you. Resilience is putting policies and structures in place so that you can quickly adapt given uncertain. So resilience might be things like the Chorro Flats. Increased flooding because of rain on snow events may occur. Restored wetlands, hang on and mitigate. And so it can be an ecosystem-based resilience. Resilience can also be having structures in place so that you can respond quickly. And this can be political, economic, and educating communities so that if unexpected and unpredictable events occur, that a community can respond quickly. That's resilience. And honestly, I think it's going to be a combination. What you need to watch for your communities is that they use a very thorough decision framework for deciding what's the best strategy for each impact. Action in the face of uncertainty. There are some things where we're not sure if it's going to happen, but boy, if it does, it could be really bad. And recognizing those things that, you know, even though we're not sure and it would be difficult or expensive to do, we can't not do it. Potentially, although sea level rise on the outside of the spit could narrow the spit, which could be something that, may be a potential impact. For that, if you were going to go towards looking at climate change here, that would mean spending a lot of time with local scientists. I have another overlay here. This is the Oakland, South Oakland, San Francisco airport. When I talk about no risk kinds of things, what does San Francisco do about their airport? That's a huge investment. A 1.4 meter sea level rise, which is the potential projected. Do you move it? Can you risk saying, you know, to save money, we'll leave it, but what if it rises and we'll have to somehow, in short term, move our airport? But that's when I talk about no risk, is deciding how much may end up underwater and what things do we have to move simply because we can't risk having that happen. And those are the kinds of choices cities should be making. Collaboration, the name of the kind of the game of this conference and certainly of climate planning, is that you need collaboration both community-wide. It's not just city governments, but collaboration from economic actors as well as the community to collectively respond and support and understand changing threats and regionally, because these are impacts that aren't just going to happen to a particular city, but entire regions. And so you need regional collaboration so you don't have very differing responses. All right, a few things just to look at them. So this is a projected temperature increase. And you can see that we're living in an odd bubble that doesn't seem to have a huge amount of increase. But as on a state level, there are some areas that will see a huge change. And temperature has some secondary impacts. So this is extreme heat in a few cities, and you can see the best case scenario to worst case scenario. But heat is related to air quality because it takes heat to produce ozone, which is why you get air quality warnings in LA. Well, now you're talking about health risks associated to it with this extreme heat. So you can start to see these trickle-down secondary effects. Increased wildfire. And this becomes an important one. And when you start talking about what's the big risk, Southern California will still have fire, but not a huge change. And they're used to dealing with it. They have emergency response systems and building codes for protected space. Northern California, much less so. But there's a huge projected increase for forest fires. So the need for planning for adaptation, it's going to be disappearing with climate change. So 80%. And that's just medium, not the worst case scenario, by 2070 in terms of snowpack. So when you talk about drinking water, this is a statewide issue, and you're starting to see communities up and down the coast take very seriously protecting long-term water supplies. Let's go. All right, we're going to move on to mitigation really quickly. And talk a little bit about this. And as a reminder, so that the county kicked off their planning process just 2 days ago. There'll be many more public meetings. I would encourage you to go. Morro Bay is in the middle of doing their inventory. San Luis Obispo is in the middle of doing their inventory, as is true of their plan. Actually, their inventory's out. And so to pay attention, because these issues will be brought up and addressed regionally here. So mitigation is, how do we reduce our emissions? All the cities have joined ICLEI. It's the world's worst acronym. It stands for Local Governments for Sustainability. Yes. So ICLEI has nothing to do with the organization. It once actually stood for something. The organization changed their name to Local Governments for Sustainability and kept their acronym, which is horrible, but that's what they did. All of the local cities, and actually over 90% of the communities in the U.S. that have enacted climate policy, have joined ICLEI. When you join ICLEI, you sign on to a three-step process. Inventory what you're creating in terms of adopt a target, write a plan, implement it, and check how it worked. So I'm going to be talking mostly about climate plans, or CAPs. What do they do? A CAP should summarize where your emissions are coming from I worked with the city of Benicia up in the Bay Area on their climate plan. 90% of their emissions come from a Valero refinery. If you take the refinery away, it's 70% industrial still. A plan for that city needed to address industrial emissions. I recently worked with the city of San Luis Obispo. 50% of their emissions come from transportation. A good plan for San Luis Obispo needs to face transportation. You should adapt. These plans should have adaptive measures in them. Big piece is bringing together the community. So much of this is based on individual action and behavior change. Government can't do this. You need to incentivize and hope people will choose to carpool, to ride their bikes, to walk, to circulation and land use plan. That's incredibly important and powerful. These plans make sense. Using less energy saves you money, saves your city government money, it saves all of you money. It also improves community health. In addition to GHGs, a lot of fossil fuel-based emissions carry with them a whole host of other air quality factors, for example. Content of the cap, sources of your emissions, forecasts, your reduction target, your mitigation actions, so your actions of what you do. And this is where climate plans are different than most other city documents. They're quantitative. Each action that's identified, the city will quantify what kind of emissions reduction will result from implementing this. So if you have a target, the collection of policies need to demonstrate how they'll reach that target. In addition, it should have a phasing. When should you implement this? Is this something for 2015, 2020, or something to do next week? Indicators. How are we going to check if it's working? It's not just GHGs, but you need to check for how many more people are riding the bus, how many homes have been retrofit, how many kilowatts of renewable energy are being locally generated. And then also the cost. How much will it cost to implement? How much will we save? And what are our financing options? The county has signed on to California First. That's property-assessed clean energy. It allows you to upgrade your home and put renewable energy on your roof, solar panels, and repay it through your property tax over 20 to 30 years. These are financing mechanisms that are going on right now in our county. And then adaptation actions. And this is actually my last slide. So what do mitigation actions look like for those of you who haven't read a climate plan? Transportation. This is mode change. How do you get more people to ride their bike, walk, ride the bus? This can be more connected infrastructure, better bike lanes, a more connected regional transit system, particularly in the county. Working with land use to make things closer together. Also, how do you make people drive fewer miles? That's, again, land use. Energy. This is both renewable energy generation, solar panels, wind power, but also energy efficiency. We're not a really fast growth area, meaning most of our energy is used in existing buildings. We need to retrofit them. How do we encourage people to do that, and how do we make that easy and treat it? Agriculture. The county will have an agriculture chapter in their cap. Agricultural machinery, soil management, ruminant digestion, which is a very nice way of saying cow burps, is a source of methane. And so those practices need to be related, and you'll see chapters, and there's actually emerging research on that. Parks and open space, more trees sequester GHGs. They provide shade. They allow your buildings to use less water. Street trees encourage people to walk more because it feels more safe. So you'll start to see chapters like that as well in these policies, in these plans. And so those are things I would look for as a local community member, because over the next year or two, you're going to see this front and center and see a huge number of community meetings. The other thing I should mention is that with climate change, you're going to see ecosystems shift. And so you see climate planning elements in things like forest service management plans and natural resource management plans. It should be integrated almost through everything, because the impacts are through most everything, from city plans to resources. And with that, that's it. I'll happily answer questions. This was more, hopefully, an overview to kind of raise awareness of what's going on.
there are several, several cities in our county that are repaying property owners for removing their grass at different rates.
How is that funded? Wow, I got loud.
Cash for grass programs can be funded in a variety of ways, and it's often up to individual cities. They can fund it from programs from taking a portion of, if they have a local water utility, they can even use it funding from their local water bills. They can pull it from their general plan. You can also see programs for when new development comes in. You can pay an impact fee of the new developments and use that fee to fund programs. There's also state-level funding and grants that can help fund similar programs. But each jurisdiction uses differing programs. And cash for grass programs are fairly common, and you'll see them throughout California, but also most. There's two things I'll say. First, on population, and one of the interesting things when you look at these targets, you'll see cities adopting targets of 15% below 2005 levels, which is the most common baseline. That doesn't account for population growth at all. And if you think about looking at some historic baseline and trying to get back to 1990 levels in the Central Valley, you're talking about communities that barely existed in the 1990s that are now projected to be at 20 and 30,000 residents. Hard and fast targets are tough. And so you're starting to see air boards define thresholds just like they do for many others. And some have started to define per capita thresholds rather than community, because they realize for fast growth communities, it's difficult. Under the 2050 state goal, we need to have a state average of about 4 metric tons of GHGs per capita, which is quite a bit less from, I think we're somewhere in the 12 to 14 range as a state right now. That's a dramatic decrease. So in terms of population, it's a very politically unpopular thing to talk about. And the one way you see it addressed is by talking about trying to truly decrease per capita so that the cost of additional people in terms of greenhouse gas emissions is much less. The snowpack is a much scarier prospect. That is why you see proposals for new reservoirs, whether you think that's a good idea or not. That's what's driving it. That's why you see the peripheral canal back on the board up in the Bay Area. That's why you see desal being considered by many coastal communities these days, which is an interesting one because it's adaptive, but desal is incredibly energy intensive. But I think that is perhaps the most pressing. And I would argue that water is getting housed in the climate planning area, partly because that's the place where you can get funding to do it, and it's a big new legislative direction. I would argue that many communities would probably be better served by simply addressing water as a central, huge issue because it is so important. What's interesting, I talked recently to a climate scientist, and he said, you know, you might see more snow in the southern because you need warm air to get snow. And so in the Sierras, you may see slightly more snow. And if you look at regional specifics, however, you may see more melting and rain. So rain on snow events create a lot of downstream flooding as well. But you accurately point out a huge issue moving forward. I think there was one person that had a question back there. A tough one because it's talking about global warming refers to average global temperature, where climate change refers to shifts in climate, recognizing that there are places on the planet that may get colder, that may have more rain rather than less, that it's a shift. In terms of the policy realm, what's nice, well, nice, but one piece as a planner, I find that now that the state there's mandate, so you can't build and you can't get a general plan adopted anymore without addressing it, that from a policy and plan making perspective, it's the choices about what are you mitigating and what kind of impacts are you dealing with is out of the policymakers' hands at the local level now because it's been mandated on a state level. And so you take the best available science you can find from the state and move forward. It is spatially unequal, so not everyone is expected, and it is uncertain science. We know it is changing. We know that the global average temperatures have been going up, so the bay has risen a foot in the last 100 years. So we're in it. I mean, it is rising, whether it's our fault, They think it is, but there's still plenty of debate on that. However, we have been mandated on a state level to deal with it with state-level targets. So you're going to see this happening almost out of the political debate around climate change itself and the science, because it's now a legislative mandate in many ways. So. Let's do this. This is the last one. Okay. In purple.
With California public schools having more emphasis on reading and math due to testing and other things, science often is left behind. How can we better prepare the people who are really going to be dealing with these statistics for a better future?
I absolutely agree. I certainly know that you are starting to see some of these city plans start to closely involve the school system. So there's state funding for things like solar shade at high school parking lots and things now, but you'll also see it integrated into curriculum. So I know that the city of Benicia, with whom I worked, they used part of their funding and implementation to fund a high school enterprise program to have the high school students do energy audits. Transportation is just good planning. And so you do see a lot of cities going towards safe routes to school, having educational gardens at schools being integrated into those plans. And so you are seeing some of that integration continuing to happen. So with that.
All right, with that, we're going to switch gears a little structurally. The next couple of topics, we'll have two or three presenters, and then we'll take questions as a whole. And with that, I will introduce me, myself. Get my PowerPoint up. All right. So I'm going to cover marine debris. I am Sherry Sullivan. I'm the Education and Outreach Coordinator at the Estuary Program, and I wanted to point that out because I'm not a scientist working on this topic. I'm not qualified to address it from that level. I'm qualified to address the broad topic, answer a few questions that I get asked a lot when I'm out and about. So that's where I'm coming from, and if you ask me specific questions about research, I'm not going to be able to answer them for you. But I can tell you what marine debris is. Now, NOAA defines it as any persistent solid material that is manufactured or processed and directly or indirectly, intentionally or unintentionally, disposed of or abandoned into the marine environment or the Great Lakes. So, if you're still awake, really, marine debris is largely plastic. And as you can see, 90% of the floating ocean trash is plastic. There are concerns about other materials that are not floating. It's much more complicated, and I think really more than I have time to tackle here. So most of what I'm going to be talking about is plastic. So I want to be very clear. There are other debris problems out there. I have a little bit of information about some of those, but I'm really going to focus on plastics in the marine environment. So why is it a problem? It's probably the next big question to answer. In a nutshell, plastic photodegrades. It does not biodegrade. It does not go away. It is not going to go in your compost bin and fertilize your plants one day. It's going to break down smaller and smaller and smaller. That's where we really run into the problem. This slide, if you can read it from there, it's not a real high resolution slide, shows the period of time things take to degrade. Glass bottle, 1 million years. No, hopefully we're going to be recycling those. So the other concern about plastics is that it's very harmful to wildlife. And I should warn you, the next slides are not pleasant. So if you're particularly sensitive, beware. You have problems with entanglement, which causes anything from suffocation to drowning and a number of other problems. These are all, I believe these are all from NOAA, these images. So you can see it's not the most pleasant thing for the wildlife. The next slide really illustrates the problem of ingestion. This is the work of a photographer named Chris Jordan. And he went to an area, very remote, and photographed a large number of these birds. These are albatross. And I think, really, he says it better than anybody else. I'm going to read his quote as to what he said about these images. I only am going to torment you with one. He says, "These photographs of albatross chicks were made in September 2009 on Midway Atoll, a tiny stretch of land and coral near the middle of the North Pacific. The nesting babies are fed, bellies full of plastic by their parents, who soar out over the vast polluted ocean, collecting what looks to them like food to bring back to their young. On this diet of human trash, every year tens of thousands of albatross chicks die on Midway from starvation, toxicity, and choking. To document this phenomenon as faithfully as possible, not a single piece of plastic in any of these photographs, or this photograph, was moved, placed, manipulated, arranged, or altered in any way. These depict the actual stomach contents of baby birds in one of the world's most remote marine sanctuaries, more than 2,000 miles from the nearest continent." So I personally find it really disturbing that it's being fed to babies, but that's my side note. So where does all the plastic go? And here's the one that I find people are really interested in: the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. The first thing I want to point out is people often think it's the gyre. The gyre is, in the most simplistic terms, the currents, the wind currents, ocean currents, that create, let's see, these swirling motions. This is a graphic from, I think it was the San Francisco Chronicle. Let's see, here's Hawaii, if you can't quite see it from where you are. So you get an idea of where we're talking about, sort of cycling around this way. There's San Francisco, you can probably see that. Excuse me. So this is where the majority of the garbage pastel unified patch, it moves, it changes shape, you can't really see it from satellite pictures. It's more of a soup. So this is, I believe it was the Algalita that's doing research. They did a trawl for plankton, and this is the kind of stuff you're getting, that broken down plastic that just makes this soup. And that's sort of in contrast to some of the pictures I showed you, but you can really see where this becomes a problem for marine life consuming this stuff. It also tends to outnumber plankton in these areas. This was, as you can see, a trawl for zooplankton, however the right pronunciation is. Let's see here. So another big question is, okay, so you've got this giant patch of this nasty stuff out there. Well, how does it get there? Pretty simple. We put it there. 80% of it comes from land-based sources. So some is dumped directly. I often hear people saying, okay, it's got to be all the transcontinental voyage. No, it's mostly from land-based sources. And that's where watershed issues really come into play. This is, I don't know if you can read this, it's San Gabriel, and this is a common sight from what I've been told by folks who live down there after a rainstorm. So again, we talked a little bit about watershed earlier on. I think Anne mentioned it, you know, anything that happens up in the upper watershed washed down into whatever waterway it heads to. So we're getting a lot of trash off of the streets into water systems, and eventually, one way or another, they make it out to the ocean. Wind also blows things around quite a lot. Let's see. There was an organization that came here in November, Sea Life Conservation. They have a 65-foot research sailing vessel, and they're based up in Santa Cruz. They work with the Monterey Bay Aquarium. They do mapping of marine debris in Monterey and San Francisco. Excuse me. This shows a little further breakdown of what they've found. This is San Francisco, and I think it's pretty self-explanatory. Hopefully you can see the colors distinctly enough. They found that 47% of what they found in San Francisco Bay was styrofoam, 33% of it was plastic, and they had sort of a miscellaneous category of another 20%. I believe when I spoke to Captain Dave, he said a lot of that was cigarette butts and some other strange stuff. Sometimes they found some paper. But we don't have a real problem with marine debris real close to us, but of course, it's not a local problem. It's a more regional problem. They continue to work on this. This is a shot of one of the crew members grabbing some stuff just outside of Morro Rock. So, again, we're looking big picture here. The question becomes, what can be done about this? I'm going to trust that our next speaker, Mike, is going to talk a lot more about local efforts for handling trash once we've generated it. There's a few things that are going on that are really relevant. The estuary program has funded a couple of different programs. Lose the Foam is one that's in process right now. It's a really great program. I was hoping that we'd have somebody here to tell you about it, but they're up against the end of the school year. It's a group from Morro Bay High who has decided that styrofoam is really probably not the best source for takeout containers. The kids are doing an education campaign and going out to business owners to educate them. They don't want to mandate anything. They want to inform, provide alternatives, and see what kind of a response they get. And that's just beginning. The kids, I believe, last I heard, they are just about to start going out and meeting with business owners. Really great idea, really great project. Hopefully we can report some more about that later on. There's also a project that happened we provide some funding for. The Harbor Festival had moved towards they attempted a zero waste, and they came very close. They provided the compostable takeout containers in lieu of styrofoam and plastics, also diverted a huge amount of food waste, not the topic of this conversation, and had great success with that and were met very well. They're attempting this year to move it to a no-smoking event to handle the cigarette butts. Again, slightly off topic, but there's a lot of people making a lot of efforts to mitigate this problem. California Coastal Cleanup Day is also a great resource. Hopefully you guys are familiar with that. They go through and take a lot. I think I have a slide in the next one that shows a few folks cleaning up. Getting the trash off the beach, obviously, is a huge issue. There's policy changes around the corner. Let's see. Assembly Bill 1998 is looming before, I believe it's the California Assembly. It was introduced in February of this year, and it's looking to, let's see here if I can, basically ban, I believe they've added paper bags, but definitely the plastic, limiting our use of single-use plastics. Here's a couple of things, other things that were going on, as I mentioned, the California Cleanup Day. This is a shot from the T-Pier dive cleanup that happens every year. A group of divers, local divers, and folks from as far away as the Central Valley go into the T-Pier and pull up whatever's down there that's not supposed to be there. There's a little controversy over this, I'll have to admit. Some folks who dive there regularly are firmly believing that the material down there becomes habitat and that by removing it, you're removing habitat. I'm not going to try to address that one way or the other. People are entitled to their opinion either way. However, I will say that a radio is not useful. They pulled up, I think there were six or eight CDs, radios, VCRs, various things like that. There was a dryer that may still be down there. A number of batteries. So there's a few things down there, and that's where, you know, obviously we're still looking at some plastics, but this isn't floating debris. So there's a number of items down there that still really need to be pulled up, even if you want to argue that, you know, the beer bottles provide habitat, which they certainly have imagery that they do. So a number of things can be done. Hopefully now, as I said, you all have your MBNEP bags and can respond to the possible change in legislation. That's pretty much the overview that I wanted to provide on marine plastics. I'll be taking some questions with Mike after we get his presentation. I'm trying to do two things at once here. I think Mike will provide a lot more information about what's being done locally. San Luis Obispo County has some very interesting projects going on and programs. I think it's a very worthwhile thing to look at. So that said, Mike is, let me get my notes here, with the San Luis Obispo Integrated Waste Management Authority, he's the Education Programs Coordinator, and I'm going to let him tell you all about what we're doing locally. So, Mike.
Deport.
Yeah, here we go, right here.
Let's see if this works.
All right, give it a shot.
Backwards. Raise your hand if you've even heard of it. I'm really curious. Oh, my goodness. This is a very, very educated audience. For those of you who haven't heard of the IWMA, as I'll call it from here, we're a very small organization that helps all of the cities and the counties meet their solid waste and recycling mandates as directed by a law called AB 939. So we'll talk about that later. So what do? We operate our household hazardous waste programs in the county. We'll talk about that today. We deliver grant funds. When available, we go to Sacramento and bring back money from different agencies so that we can be more effective at recycling here in San Luis Obispo County. We act as a local resource so that all of our cities can meet the mandates of AB 939, which we'll talk about. And we have an education program where we do about 700 programs every year. They may be class presentations or trips out to the landfill and recycling center. I'm going to share some of that with you in our program today. So what I want to do is give you some maybe different perspectives on solid waste and recycling, and I also want to follow the path of what happens to some of these things that we put out on the curb, because most of us just see a truck come and it hauls it away. I get calls in my office from time to time, and people tell me that the materials that go in their blue recycling center are actually dumped in the landfill, and we're not really recycling those materials. So I offer then to take them on a field trip and show them. So that's kind of what we'll do today in part. So anyway, we're going to start by taking a look at trash. We have three landfills in our county, Cold Canyon, Chicago Grade, and the Paso Robles landfill. All the pictures I'm showing you here are of Cold Canyon. That's where I spend most of my time. And when we combine those three landfills, 850 tons a day of municipal solid waste. Okay? Did it all need to go into the landfill? Probably not. So what happens to it once it is there? Well, first of all, no one's going to run through there and pick out the bottles and the cans and the recyclables. They're going to be buried forever, just plain and simple. A compactor, which weighs 40 tons, is going to drive over and over and over that material because we want to densify it. We want to save space. We want to build a landfill that's solid and have as much room left at the end of the day as we can. So this compactor is really fun to watch. It shakes the ground if you get close enough, and that's what's going to happen to anything that goes to a landfill. So a lot of people, though, think of landfills as compost piles. Are they? Not really. Remember, we're smashing that solid waste, so we don't have a lot of air in between down. So we realized that things aren't breaking down so quickly. And let's see, can anyone guess, how did they date the layers of trash? How did they know, like, a certain layer of trash had been there for 4 months or 6 months? New, beautiful. Newspapers. The newspapers weren't breaking down so quickly either. So you read the dates on the newspapers as you go down through the landfill. I know someone's going to think, radiocarbon dating? No, it's easier than that. Just read the darn newspaper, and there it is. So anyway, of course, if we bury some carrots in our backyard soil like that, they decompose pretty quickly. So anyway, if we've got organics, that's what we call them, going into our landfill, food, green waste, as those decompose, we're going to get landfill gases. 99% of landfill gases are carbon dioxide and methane. By law, landfill must take those or pull those out of the landfill. If they don't, those gases are going to migrate down, potentially getting into groundwater. Or if they don't do that, they're going to seep out and they're going to create greenhouse gases, and we all know about those. So anyway, so we've got a gas well here. This is at Cold Canyon. So now we're pulling out millions of cubic feet of gas a month. What are we going to do with this flammable gas? Well, some landfills burn it, and you go by and you see this big torch going, and they're just burning them. Some landfills create electricity with that. I went on a field trip to a landfill in Monterey, and that's exactly what they do. At Cold Canyon right now, they're sending the gas over right here to a place called PXP in Price Canyon, where they're drilling for oil. And the crude is relatively thick, and they inject steam into the oil well. Well, how do you make steam? You boil water, and for that, you need a fuel to make the water hot. It's the gas from your rotting garbage. Isn't that really interesting? So I was at a meeting the other day, though, and the head of the company that owns the landfill locally was saying, you know what? We're going to get the infrastructure in so that we can also take this gas and use it to run our garbage trucks. So they're already running some of the trucks on compressed natural gas, which they purchased, but what they're going to do is start using this. And so I love that because interpretively that's another fun thing to talk about. So anyway, so that's what's happening, all as a result of organics going into landfills. If we could get everybody to compost, the gas emissions would be down to just about nothing. All right, who can connect the dots? What does this have to do with anything we've been talking about so far? Seagulls, yeah. So over at Cold Canyon and other landfills, 6 days a week, working all hours that the landfill is open just because we have organics going into the landfill. It's not cheap to hire a falconer to be on your site all day, I can tell you. So maybe there's some better solutions. All right, so we're talking about solid waste. Let's figure out what is it composed of. So every year the US EPA does a study. An organization called the Franklin Group does it. And here it is. This is really surprising to a lot of people because when the personal computer came out many years ago, we said, or many people said, we're going to become a paperless society. Look at the largest portion of our solid waste stream. It is paper. I have to tell you, though, this is going down. 4 or 5 years ago, it was around 40%. So that paper portion is going down, which is pretty good. And so anyway, this is all by weight, what we're looking at here. So look at this. Food scraps, easily compostable. Yard trimmings, easily compostable. Pretty easy to chip and use as a fuel, biofuel, or to compost. Most of our plastics can be recycled, with the exception of styrofoam. Most metals can be recycled. Most glass can be recycled. So based on that, as a country, you would think that we're recycling or composting most of our solid waste, right? But you know it's a trick question. So the answer is no. There's the picture. 33% is being recycled or composted, and unfortunately, 54% is going into landfills. This is a national picture, not our county. I'll kind of get to our county a little bit later on. So anyway, what we're trying to do locally, though, is make sure this part of the pie is as large as possible and our landfill part of the pie is as small as possible. So what I want to do now is see what does happen with all that stuff that you put in your blue recycling container. Where does it go? What do they do with it? Well, I'm going to use Cold Canyon as our example. This is the largest recycling center we have. Now, there's the letters MRF up there, which stands for Materials Recovery Facility. So if you're in this business, you don't call this a recycling center. You call it a MRF. So now that you all know that, you can sound very educated. People treat you in a completely different way if you use the word MRF, and that's why I'm telling you that. It could be to your advantage. So here's one of our typical recycling trucks, and these might have 10,000 pounds of recyclables in them. We call them commingled recyclables because everything is just mixed together. Bottles, cans, newspapers. And now the real job is we've got to separate all of. If I'm something smaller than 8 inches, a bottle, a can, whatever, I'm going to fall between these plates and move down to another conveyor belt that'll take me off into a different area. So here you can see the cardboard. It's floating on top of these blades or being pushed on top of the blades. And then now we're on the other side of the machine. Here you can see those blades, and it's literally throwing the cardboard down into a pile. Nobody had to touch that cardboard to separate it from all the other recyclables. So years ago, they had guys standing there going like this. You want to talk about, you know, repetitive types of injury. So this is a really good answer to sorting cardboard out from the stream. So now the cardboard has gone this way. Everything else has fallen down here onto this conveyor belt. So now we're going up. We're going to move our perspective. All right, here's everything else besides the cardboard, papers, bottles, and cans. And there are some discs here pushing everything up this way. But again, now if I'm heavier than paper, a bottle or a can, can't really see it too well. Right here, I'm going to go over these discs and fall down and go on to another conveyor belt. At the top here, there are air blowers pushing the paper up toward the top. And again, the air is not so strong it's going to push a bottle or a can up there. So now we're separating the paper from everything else. So now we're up on top. We're 18 feet above the ground. All these conveyor belts are working. By the way, if you've never been to a MRF, most people haven't. They're amazing places. This one's 50,000 square feet. It's incredibly noisy. And sometimes if you're near the right machines, the floor is shaking. And it's just an amazing environment to be in for about 20 minutes. And after that, you want to get out. All right, so now we're up on top. This is the paper line, but there were things that got into the paper that weren't separated. Maybe there's a lid from a yogurt container, who knows what else. So we have individuals now going to pull out the contaminants. Now, this line should have mostly bottles and cans and heavy things. And what we want to do, even though there's some paper in there, what we want to do now is get out the aluminum cans. They're really valuable. That's the real big cash crop at our recycling center is aluminum cans. Now, in the old days, again, someone stood there and pulled out aluminum cans. This thing right here creates what's called an eddy current. And it creates this electromagnetic current, and as an aluminum can goes by, it takes the can and it flings it off the conveyor belt into its own container. So here we are. Here's everything. The current's going across here. We've got cans flying in the air. Look at the spam. Way up here, and as the materials get sorted, they fall back down to ground level. So here is our pathway to the baler right here. And again, there's the baler, and there are the many bales that are made. So at the MRF that we just looked at, on a typical day, maybe 120 tons of recyclables are going through there, okay? About 120 tons a day, sometimes more, sometimes less, depending on the economy, the time of the year, and so on. So what I want to do now is leave the MRF and take you on a short field trip to San Jose, California, because people always ask me, well, what happens with the stuff after you get it? Where do you send it? What do you do with it? The answer is your materials get sent all over the world in this global economy that we have. But it was a lot easier to go to San Jose than China. A lot of our paper now is sent to China, but this is a paper recycling mill in San Jose that I visited one day. Here comes your used newspapers and materials. They fall into this pulper, which was, I think, about 12 feet in diameter, and it's literally just chopping up the paper in some water. So eventually this will look like this, kind of like a thin oatmeal mixture. So the next step, that is thinned out, and this stuff that looks like unfiltered apple juice is 99% water, 1% paper fiber. And what's happening is this is falling now onto a screen that's about 10 feet wide, and that screen traps the paper fibers and lets the water percolate through. Problem with getting good photography at a paper mills is most everything is enclosed in metal casings and things like that, so it's very difficult to see what's going on. As the paper fibers have been caught on these screens, which are moving at 45 to 90 miles an hour, there are vacuums that suck out the excess water. The fibers are pressed together. They go through a dryer. And when you're all done, we've got our roll of paper. This was chipboard they were making that day, which is the material that would be a cereal box. And so this paper machine was 1,200 feet long. And it started with that unfiltered apple juice stuff, and it ends with this. So anyway, paper mills are fascinating if you have a chance to go to one. But anyway, that's an example of how some of our materials are processed. Okay, so why are we doing all this stuff? Why not just dump it in the landfill? Well, lots of different answers, but even if you weren't an environmentalist in California, there's this law called AB 939, the Integrated Waste Management Act, and that's the blueprint for how we're going to manage solid waste and recyclables. Lower, 2.7 pounds in 1960, about 4.5. Again, this is national numbers that we're talking about now. So first, let's make less trash. Second, what we do have left over, let's recycle it, let's compost it, and then last, let's find environmentally safe methods of disposing of what we can't recycle or compost. So those are our waste diversion mandates, and if a city or county does not do that, they can be fined up to $10,000 per day. And the goal is that every city divert 50% of all of the solid waste that it makes from landfills. Okay? If they're under that 50, they can be fined. So the question is, in San Luis Obispo County, how are we doing? What's our diversion rate? How much stuff are we keeping out of the landfill? And there we are. So 67%, we've exceeded our 50, so we're in pretty good shape. But then that begs the question, well, 67, but why not 77? Why not 87? Where should we put the bar and measure how successful we're doing now? So now there's this idea of, well, maybe we should be a zero waste city, a zero waste state. So our definition of zero waste is going to be landfill diversion of 90% or greater. So cities now are really starting to discuss this seriously on how to get to be a zero waste city. Now, if you think of Fresno, California, and it's not a criticism of Fresno, do you think of them as being on the leading edge of the environmental forefront in terms of, some people do, a lot of people don't. They adopted, the city of Fresno, a zero waste resolution that by the year 2025, they will become a zero waste city, and they're taking steps to do that. So anyway, that's the idea. So now, what are the pathways to zero waste? How can we get there? I put this slide in because I work with a lot of young people, and oftentimes their solution is, well, they call me Mr. Mike, let's just send this stuff toward the sun, and it'll burn up, and then we don't have to worry about landfilling and landfill gases and all that. And so I just had to make this up one day just to address that. And then we realize when we start to think about it that that stuff that we think is a liability is really natural resources, all those things. So let's not think of it as waste anymore. Let's think of these things as natural resources, which we actually need. So ways to get to zero waste, alternatives to landfilling. Most landfills now have what we call resource recovery parks. Someone goes to the landfill, and instead of just having to get rid of them in a safe manner. So this is at Cold Canyon. We get a lot of old CRT monitors and television sets now, paints and other materials. Also, let's address businesses. IWMA offers free waste audits to businesses. Someone will come out, they will literally go into the dumpster, spread everything out on a large tarp, and figure out what percent of that business's waste stream is paper, plastic, etc., and then determine what percentage could be recycled, and maybe adjust the size of the recycling container, making it larger, and maybe downsizing the dumpster. No charge to have that waste audit done. And of course, a business can save money if they reduce the size of their waste container, because generally the rate, the garbage rate, is set on the size of that container, not on the size of that container. So good deal for businesses. All right, another way to get to zero waste, take back programs. So the concept is, if you're purchasing something, why don't we have the retailers and producers of those items take responsibility, or at least some? We call it producer responsibility. Let's start with paint. How many of you knew that in our county, if you purchase a gallon of paint, the retailer must take the paint back from you if you want to have some left over, and when they take it back, they may not charge you a fee? Okay, very, very few people. So we have a county take-back ordinance for paint. So really handy to know if you've got that leftover paint. Now, our household hazardous waste facilities will take that also, but the chances are that paint store is a lot closer to you and easier to get to than the hazardous waste facility. We have a take-back ordinance for batteries. Any store that sells batteries must take batteries back from you at no cost. Now, the retailer does have the option, though, to increase the price of the paint or the batteries when you purchase them. If they want to add a nickel to the cost of the paint or whatever, they may do that, but they may not have a fee that they charge you when you bring those back. CFLs or other fluorescent light bulbs, again, every store that sells those must take them back. So that's a really convenient way, because the chances are when you're low on batteries or you've got some dead ones, you make one trip, you get the new ones, and get rid of the old ones all at the same time. And sharps, okay? Our pharmacies now have these sharp containers for needles and lances and things like that. They give them to you. When they're full, you bring them back to the pharmacy, and it's supposed to be consumer friendly. All right. And then part of our zero waste, if we're going to make recycling economy work, is we've got to buy recycled stuff. We have the technology to recycle just about everything, but if the products that we make from those aren't being sold on the store, then our recycling economy is weak and fragile and falls apart. So recycled paper, you know, years ago, very difficult to find. Quality may have been substandard. Today, terrific recycled papers at very competitive prices. And as they say in the infomercials, but wait, there's more. I was at the store the other day, and I was so happy to see this. I'd been waiting for this. My priorities are a little different than some people's. I could never figure out how aluminum is so easy to recycle. How come we can't buy recycled aluminum foil? There it was at Albertsons the other day. I bought it immediately, and then I went back, and there hasn't been any since then. So I don't know how widely this is made. I went to the Reynolds website, and they said that the reason they haven't done it sooner was they've had a hard time getting the correct feedstock to make this, the clean, relatively clean used aluminum to make the foil. So anyway, so buying recycled is so important to keep our recycling economy strong and to make recycling work. So anyway, some examples of just what benefits would we derive by using paper with recycled content that's just at 50%. And here are some of the numbers. If you bought paper with 100% recycled content, you could just about double all these red numbers on the right. So anyway, those are some of the benefits of using recycled content paper. Now I want to show you the benefits of recycling another item that we all use. When someone figures out what item this is, just say so. Maybe someone else has figured it out. I'm going to show you what we have to do to make that item. First of all, we don't have the raw materials in the United States, so we have to go abroad and dig it out of the ground, and those are the raw materials that we may need to make this item that we all use, or most of us use. There's a close-up of it. Then we have to convert, or put that on a ship, excuse me, and send it to the United States so that we can convert it into this material. And then this material is added to some chemicals and goes to a smelter, all to make that. So does anybody know what that first red stuff was that we saw on there? Box. Oh, this audience is so brilliant. All right, so that was bauxite. All right, so here's the thing. The energy billion dollars. So not just bad management of resources, bad money management burying $1 billion a year in landfills. Okay. So if we recycle this can, we can get rid of most of that smelting. This white powder is called alumina. We don't have to make the alumina again. We don't have to transport it across the ocean, and we don't have to mine it out of the earth in the first place. So if you recycle one aluminum can, you save enough energy to run a 100-watt light bulb for about 8 hours. Huge energy savings. Now, if you were third graders, I'd bring out an electrical generator with a light bulb and make you turn it for 8 hours. That's what we do with our kids. And then it really sinks in that, okay, I'd rather recycle the can than have to generate 8 hours worth of electricity. But I won't put you all through that. So anyway, all right, so we've just taken a real thumbnail look, a brief look at what's going on with solid waste in our county, what's going on maybe nationally with some of the numbers. We can do a lot better than we are. Our county is better than most, though, in terms of recycling and diverting things from the landfill. We published a 16-page guide in the current AT&T phone book for people who want to know more about recycling and solid waste. You can contact me or anyone from our staff at IWMA.com. And with that, I just say thank you for being such a great audience today. Okay, questions, comments, ideas? Yes.
Pharmaceuticals, bad for water, but the way they tell us to dispose of them properly in terms of protecting water is not good for landfills. Can you tell me what's on the horizon for a proper disposal of pharmaceuticals?
I would rather see pharmaceuticals go to a landfill than a wastewater plant. And I think the chances, if the pharmaceuticals are in a proper container, that there must much less opportunity for them to be damaging to the environment if the landfill is managed properly. As far as what's on the horizon, I can't really say where we're going to go from here, because what we're doing does seem sort of primitive, but it's the best that we have now. So, sorry, I can't give you a more prophetic answer than that.
I really enjoyed your talk there.
Thank you.
First of all, I want to thank the Estuary Program for putting this on. But what I like to say is I do several things. People in this room could do the same thing that I do before it reaches to your area. One is I have a worm bed. Worms love garbage, and it doesn't smell in my worm bed. Now, we don't put one except for meat products. We recycle that in the worm bed. And all of us, all this paper, all this garbage that we receive in the mail, this junk mail, I grind it up and I put it in my worm bed. And they just love it. They just chew it up. If every household had a worm bed, do you realize how much we save just going into our sewers and to the land dumps? And the second thing I'd like to talk about is that late Dorn, Mr. Dorn, came to this town. He used to be a county supervisor in L.A., he saw Morro Bay as a trash dump, and he started this program, and we do it every Monday morning. We go to Doran's restaurant, he gives us free coffee, and we go out and pick up trash on Monday mornings through Friday, but mainly Monday morning because visitors come into our town and throw trash all over the place. And so we pick up the trash off our cities, but I like to say, three things that really bug me. One is cigarette butts. You go out to the Embarcadero Monday morning and there's hundreds of cigarette butts that end up in our estuary. Secondly is dog poop. Now you go out at the rock and there's dog poop all over the place, even though we have a MIT program here in Morro Bay that some people just don't use it. And so I'd like to leave it like that, but if anybody would like to volunteer, they're more than welcome to come to Doran's restaurant. And a lot of people don't come, but there's about 20, 30 of us that do this every week. Now, a person from Arroyo Grande saw me. He came up to me and said, "What are you doing?" And I'm saying, "Well, blah, blah, blah." And he said, "You know, we try a program like this in Arroyo Grande, but nobody wanted to do it." So I think other cities should be doing this too. And also want to thank Annie over here, because we have that runoff. First runoff, she calls me at 4 o'clock in the morning. "Come on, Gary, it's raining. We got to get out and take water samples." But she cannot believe the garbage, even though we do pick up, that ends up in our estuary. It really ticks me off, especially the stuff in your garden.
Exactly. Thank you.
Okay. I'll make a shameless plug on the second topic with the trash collection. I'm with the Estuary Program in the middle of developing a future volunteer program outside of the volunteer monitoring program, because we do have people who are interested in volunteering to do things that maybe they aren't, you know, the volunteer monitoring program requires a certain age, a certain physical ability, a certain time commitment. So one of the things I've had my eye on is maybe continuing something with more regular cleanup efforts. So everyone out there, think about whether you might want to. If you don't want to clean up with these gentlemen on Monday morning, then contact me and maybe we can get some other supplemental stuff going on and we can coordinate with you guys. Because the cigarette butts, I didn't talk about them with the marine debris issue, but they're hugely problematic because they do retain all of the chemicals from the cigarette, and they are plastic more or less. You know, I'm taking some liberty here, but they're not cotton that biodegrades, and they just, they're nasty, nasty, nasty things. And I agree, every time I walk down the street, they're all over the place. So they're a real problem. And I've got my eye on it, though, and we'll see if we can get that solved. So any other questions? Hold on, Jerry.
Okay. I was wondering if you could work on styrofoam more and have all the people, McDonald's or whatever, that have styrofoam or have the little doggy bags that they take from restaurants and all that, not be styrofoam, because they've got some pretty good and cost-efficient things going, but we need to get people doing that, I think.
There's a few things going with Styrofoam. A number of cities, and could be counties, I'm not entirely sure about that, have adopted some ordinances banning Styrofoam specifically. That Lose the Foam campaign that I mentioned briefly is an education campaign, an outreach campaign in advance of the possibility of, I think, a consideration. I don't want to speak for the city council, but I'll be very careful how I word this, but a consideration of some ordinance. I think that the results of the students' efforts will probably inform that effort quite a bit, but there's definitely effort and energy moving towards that here in the Morro Bay Los Osos area. We're working on it because it is...
hand after it's separated from the paper by machine. Plastic number 2, high-density polyethylene, which might be a laundry detergent container or a milk jug, would also be sorted by hand. And in addition to that, the what we call clear or natural are typically sorted from the colored number 2 because you can get a higher price if you have a bale of all clear. So largely by hand, those are being separated and then baled individually. So does that cover it? Great.
I had two quick questions. One is on the recycling center, what's the ratio of the expenses versus revenue, you know, created from that? And then the other one is new to the county, where do you find the recycling centers?
Okay. Yeah, a lot of people are surprised to learn that the recycling center is actually a for-profit business. I should have said this earlier. It's not owned by the county or the city. The one I showed you is owned by a company called Waste Connections, which is listed on the New York Stock Exchange. So they have about 4,000 employees in the western United States and operate a number of recycling facilities, landfill, and other waste-related facilities. So... also, all the staffing there are paid staff, not volunteer. And so the real question is, are they making a profit? And sometimes the answer is yes and sometimes no. Remember, they have very little control on what the price of these commodities are going to yield for them. The market in this industry is like a roller coaster. And I can remember, you know, a couple of years ago, paper, not even that long ago, maybe paper took a terrible dive, and they couldn't get enough for it to even pay for their collection and processing and shipping. To ship a ton of material out of San Luis Obispo to, say, the Port of Los Angeles cost the facility about $30 a ton. And then I'm just making this number up, maybe to collect it and process it another 15 or 20. So you might have $50 invested in a ton of material, and maybe the going rate for that is $25 a ton. Doesn't sound like a very good business model, does it? So some recyclers will sometimes hold on to bales into material, waiting for the market to go up. Many simply don't have the room to physically hold that stuff. So I can't tell you exactly what profit they made in the last quarter, but I can tell you they are profitable at time.
And we don't need to do that.
Right. So that fault, what you're addressing, falls under this whole category of producer responsibility. Let's involve the producers in giving us products that are responsibly packaged and then can be reused or recycled once we're done with them. And so now in California, we do have a nonprofit called the California Product Stewardship Commission, and they are working with industry to address exactly what you said. So they are going to make changes. Of course, some of them will be slow, some will be more immediate, but we are looking at that because packaging is huge. In some respects, Europe is ahead of us in creating packaging that's a little bit more environmentally friendly. Okay, time for one more question, okay. I'm told.
How do food or other organics that are stuck to recycling products affect the process? You know, like bits of food inside of a can or a chunk of pizza stuck to a cardboard box.
I'm glad you asked that because so many people tell me, I rinse out our glass jars and tin steel cans so that you don't have any food waste in them. And the reality is you don't need to do that. If you can take a jar or a can and shake it, or take a spoon and just scrape it, that's good enough, okay? Don't send us, though, you know, a half a can of tomato paste or something. That really is messy, and that will be a contaminant. But consider that when a glass jar, let's say it had strawberry jam in it, or a steel can, maybe it had some soup in it, goes to be processed, it's going into an oven that generally is around 23, 24, 2500 degrees, okay? The glass also is going to be cut into small pieces that we call cullet, and the glass is going to be washed at the glass processing facility before it even goes into the oven. So those temperatures are going to take care of contaminants. But so if you can just get the major parts out, that's good. But when we get a can that's half filled with whatever, when it's on that sort line that you saw, now we've got a mess, and that's not so great. But in general, please don't rinse everything out like in the washing in your dishwasher or go to, unless you want to do it for the cleanliness at your house, but don't do it for us. Paper can be recycled largely if long as it doesn't have a lot of fats, greases, or oils that have...
5 minute, maybe slightly more break. Come back about 11:30 just so you guys get a chance to stretch your legs. We'll have one more segment of presenters, and then we'll be done for the day. So about 5-8 minutes. On time. I'll give you guys a couple more minutes. All right, so the last segment we have is on the food shed. And food shed is based on the concept of a watershed, that you've got, you know, basically a small local area that's your area of influence. A definition I got was a distance between where food is produced and where it's consumed. So, you know, you may question how that really relates to the estuary. A number of topics of concern are related to agriculture for us. And what we really wanted to do was look at something a little general locally. And due to some changes in plans, we're going to be talking about oysters. So we have an oyster farmer for the third section. I'll introduce each one of those people as we go. So we're going to start with Kara Wood, who's the owner and grower at Bloom Microgreens. And she can talk about production on a small scale, sustainable farm, is that fair to say, Kara? A farm? Yes. All right, let me pull up her presentation and we'll get her going here. And again, what we're going to do is hold questions till the end and we'll put them all together so you can group the questions together. So here's Kara.
Hello. I am glad to be here to speak with you guys today. I am a small specialty farmer in Los Osos, California, and I grow microgreens, which you can see here. Microgreens are herbs, lettuces, and vegetables grown to the very first stage of growth, which is the micro stage, which basically, if you're planting your own garden and you do seed starts, when you take the your seed start and put it in the ground, I'm harvesting it at that stage, anywhere from 9 days to 3 weeks, depending on the variety of the plant. And at this stage of growth, microgreens are condensed with vitamins, minerals, and nutrients, so they really are one of the top 10 superfoods and very important to have in your diet and in the community. For many years, they were really the caviar of greens and only offered in white linen restaurants. And my goal when I started this company 2.5 years ago was to also make greens available to the community in which I live. And I currently supply 20 restaurants, 5 natural health food stores, 2 CSAs, and then a handful of local friends and family in Los Osos. I guess I want to speak mostly about the importance of supporting the local specialty farmer. We are all very lucky to live in an area where you have a huge influence of agriculture, and we're able to really make choices about the foods that we eat. And as a specialty farmer, we have the ability to offer the best of the best. I'm only growing microgreens. I'm not doing a wide variety, and I'm not growing large scale for distribution. I do all my own distribution throughout the county. So I can really be able to stay with technology and provide the best product in a sustainable fashion that's also very environmentally friendly. And I would say that is equally important with berry growers, tomato growers. When you're have a bit of an obligation to educate our children on the importance of eating local, buying local, and really supporting the local farmer, and educating them about where their food is coming from. It's very easy to walk into the grocery store and grab your apples and your lettuce, and we're all busy. But if you know, take that time to shop at the local grocery store or one of our local markets, you're really putting money back into the farmer, who can then continue to maintain and educate themselves in providing the best product in a way that's sustainable to this area. That's me. Yeah, questions at the end.
Okay, and hopefully you'll have some questions for Kara when we all convene. On another perspective, our next speaker is Robert Root. He's a chef and is the founder of an organization called Palette to Palette. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it. Robert, you can correct me when you get up here. I'm going to summarize it and see if I can. In a nutshell, it's looking to pair local farmers with local restaurants primarily, and keep, as Kara was mentioning, that circle closed and within the local community. So let me get his up here. All right.
Robert. Good afternoon, everybody. Can you guys hear me okay? My name is Robert Root, and I'm the founder of Palette to Palette. And if you haven't heard about it, it's just, Sherry, you summarized it pretty good. Founded this today. This year it's going on its fourth year, and it's about supporting the local farmers, educating the public on eating just the product that Kara mentioned, local products. But today I'm going to kind of focus on where to start. Didn't really know what to talk about today, so I focused on where we need to start all this and how do we start eating local products. Well, we start with the young generation. Because I think it's extremely important to start with the younger generation. I myself have changed my eating habits over the years because, you know, how easy is it just to pop open a bag of Doritos and chow down and you really don't stop until it's all done? You know, and it's, you know, there's so much of that product out there. You know, I don't know the crowd that's out here, but there's some great stuff out there on the market now. We've learned about that are in our foods we eat. And it's pretty scary. It's just all about what the corporations do not tell you. You know, for instance, this is a great little picture. I couldn't resist putting it in, but this is a picture that was taken of the little girl here at last year's Palette to Palette event. And it's just, she's just peeping over that, little Schaefer dish there, and it's like it almost looks like she's scared of what the other pitcher is, of all the Fritos and all that kind of stuff. And there are some young children these days that are really experimental in eating the great foods. It's just real simple. Just keep it simple, keep it fresh, and eat great products like Kara produces. You know, it's real simple. This is a great little basket from Pallet to Pallet again. All these pictures were taken by Sherry's husband, Dean Sullivan. So he doesn't know, but they're in our slideshow. But he really captured some great stuff with the local products. But, you know, one quote, I have some quotes in here for those of you who might have probably, I'm sure a lot of you probably know, Michael Pollan wrote a small little book called Food Rules. Has anybody read that? No? It's short. It's simple. Each page is just a quote. And one of them is, pay more, eat less. Okay. Sounds simple. And it makes sense. You know, instead of gorging ourselves with a 32-ounce porterhouse steak, and if you finish, it's free, you know, just pay a little bit more and eat a little bit less, you know, and I think it really makes sense. I have a little class coming up with the Slow Parks cooking demonstration, and I like to focus on, because a lot of us have families, and you're like, well, how can I cook from scratch all the time? 30 minutes or less, that's all you need from start to finish for a nice three-course meal. It may sound easy coming from a chef, because I can do it maybe faster than your average person, but yet you can make a nice, you know, potato, rice, vegetable, and a little salad dish in 30 minutes or less. And then your kids clean the dishes. That's the key. Kids clean dishes. Except for I get stuck in usually doing the dishes too. But, you know, I really try to focus on that, keeping it simple, keeping it real, and just what's in that basket that you see right here. I mean, what more do you need in a little protein? You don't need a lot of fancy tools or equipment at the house. Just a little pot, a little fry pan, and that's it. And a little bowl to mix your greens in. You know, buy local is just what we're all talking about. Buy local, seasonality. You know, a lot of people go in the grocery store nowadays, and the kids don't know that those strawberries, where they came from. It's December. There's blackberries, blueberries, strawberries, boysenberries. Oh, cool. No problem. There's $6 out there. You know, the flavor is there. Speaking from a chef's point of view, you know, the flavor is just night and day. I did a catering just the other day, and as we're serving the salad, it was 160 people sit-down dinner. I do a little moonlighting on the side with some fellow friends that own catering companies. And he goes, isn't this great stuff? It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we're getting ready to plate a salad for 160 people. The farmer picked that product that morning, and it was just like, it was just amazing stuff. Baptista Farms, I think, grows the best spinach in the world. If you haven't had it, try it. They're at a lot of local markets, especially I live in Los Osos, so I go there a lot. I think they're in downtown Slo as well. And another thing, check out the shelf life. Do yourself a test. Go buy some store-bought lettuce, and then go buy some of the farmer's market and put it in the fridge in the same container in the same location of the fridge and see which one lasts longer. This stuff will last a week. It's because it was just picked that morning. You know, you buy that stuff that's in that bag that you can't really open. Wonder why. What else is in that bag besides lettuce? I don't know. That's the scary part. CO2. There's an old saying of a product I used to buy. It's called tailpipe tuna. And the reason is, it was a tuna, the nice sashimi style, nice block, nice and thick, perfectly shaped, bright red, and used to use it for sashimi and nice tuna in the restaurant. Called the tailpipe tuna is because they inject that bag with CO2. But what does CO2 do to you? It can kill you, especially in wineries. But yet you're allowed to ingest it. It's a weird thing. I don't know a whole lot about it, but I decided to stop carrying the product just because of that. And I wasn't that familiar with it. So why serve it to my clientele? I just bought fresh whole tuna and did it myself. Pallet to Pallet website. And then another organization. How am I on time? Am I okay? Another organization, which right now, as far as I know, Dr. Scott Vernon has an organization called I Love Farmers, They Feed My Soul. They have a Facebook website. And his thing is, once again, going back to the children, is 14 to 24. He's trying to get the word out to these children that are on the college campuses to eat good local products and fresh. And also, his main focus is, where is it coming from and how is it being produced? Is it with GMO corn and all that kind of stuff? You know, really where it comes from and how it's produced. He has about 24,000 fans on the website. He started a few months back with just a few, and it just slowly just started progressing like crazy. So he goes around and speaks a lot and does things with presentation with the farmers. He teaches in the ag department at Cal Poly. He's also an author. And so, you know, it was great. A lot of people brought their own glassware. I ended up not even opening up a lot of the stuff that I purchased for the event. And I think more and more people being conscientious about recycling. And then just last but not least, some book recommendations. I have read all these except for The Recipe for America. I've heard a lot of good things about it. But there's the Michael Pollan food rules. What are some of the funny rules? Rule number one. I don't think I had it in the slide earlier. If I did, I forgot to mention it. Don't eat anything a third grader cannot pronounce. Or don't eat anything. What's that? Yeah. Yeah. Or don't eat anything your grandmother does not recognize as food. Or don't eat anything if a person had to wear a surgical mask and a white jumpsuit to prepare that food. You should. It's really a great book, and if you can go on the far side and follow some of these rules, but some of them really make sense. Just like the one, pay more, eat less. That was one of the rules, and there's just some really great quotes in there, and they all make sense. Because, or you can read The Omnivore's Dilemma, which goes into huge, heavy detail about the farming industry, or you can just forget all that really detailed stuff and follow the simple food rules. Don't have to worry about what's in it if you just buy from the basket I showed earlier. Just simple, fresh. And when you teach your children that and you bring your grandkids to the farmer's market and they pick that berry up, my daughter will not buy a basket of strawberries. She bites into it, it has to be red in the middle. Well, because they're solid white, they're not as fresh. They're out of season. So she's really picky. And when she pops those blueberries in their mouth, Dad, no, not good enough yet. They're not far enough into the season. Because the first pick of blueberries, they're not always the best. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. I go to the farmer's. Actually, my daughter now goes down to the farmer's market for me. She's 9, by the way. And my son, just the opposite. Plain eater, will not eat anything. Simple, eats about 4 ingredients, and that's about it. So I think that's about it. Just, you know, educate our children, especially with the schools. I can't push that enough. You know, that's a big problem. They're on the subsidies and a little bit of money they can spend. So other than that, we have questions and answer when we're all done. Thank you very much.
All right, and last we have George. I'm going to slaughter the pronunciation of your name, so you may have to correct me. Trevelyan, did I do okay?
In Cayucos for most of my time here. That's what brought me to Cayucos. But just last year, I left the abalone farm and decided to branch out and try being my own boss and having my own little oyster farm here in Morro Bay. And the old Williams oyster beds were being sold, and so there was a pretty much once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to jump into the oyster business here in California. It's very difficult to get these old historic leases that are very limited in number in California. And so I'm just thrilled as anything to be part of the estuary now and to be out there almost every day, and I feel really privileged to be able to be so close to the environment and to be able to be part of this organization with all these people that care about the bay so much. What I'm going to do today is first I'm going to kind of step back and look at seafood in the United States and how people kind of some trends, and then we'll zoom back into oysters and what we're doing with oysters. Let's see, I'm not sure which arrow to push. Okay, there we go. Okay, this is I took from this seafoodandwaterwatch.org website, and it just shows that Americans eat imported seafood. And so they're getting seafood from China, Vietnam, all over the world, salmon from Chile, scallops from China, catfish from Vietnam. And and so it's coming a long, long way to us. And the first thought that people have is, well, there must be a huge demand for seafood in the United States, and we just can't grow enough, we can't catch enough of it here. Therefore, there's this trade deficit, and we're importing all this seafood. And so we need to expand farms here in the U.S. to grow huge amounts of seafood to supply this great demand. But what SeafoodWatch.org was pointing out is this next slide, which is interesting. This takes a look at the seafood that is actually caught or grown in the United States. And we export it. And so it's really not that we don't have the seafood, it's that it is exported to countries. And you might wonder, why is that? Why are we exporting our seafood and then importing the seafood that we eat? And I believe the answer is just price. Americans want cheap seafood. And the cost of producing seafood, either by fishing or by farming it in the United States, is quite high. We have much more stringent regulations here, and we have to follow fishery quotas and be careful not to overfish and this sort of thing. And it's driving the price of fish and seafood that we produce here in the United States pretty high. And the fishermen want to find high-end markets, people who really appreciate high-quality seafood. And they will find those markets, and they're oftentimes in Europe or overseas. Whereas the consumer goes to, Trader Joe's or to the supermarket, and you want to find as cheap a cut of fillet as you can. And so that kind of explains that. And this next slide compares the capture fisheries with aquaculture. This is from the FAO organization, Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN. And what this shows is a comparison of capture fisheries with aquaculture. And what it's showing is the tremendous kind of meteoric rise in the importance of farmed seafood over the last 25 years or so. Whereas the capture fisheries are pretty much maxed out, and they're kind of plateauing there. And for a while there in the 80s and 90s, aquaculture was increasing at a huge percent increase per year. There were giant shrimp farms and salmon farms going in all over the world. And now the percent increase in aquaculture is really tapering off, and it's not. It's still growing, and aquaculture still is the fastest growing segment of agriculture in the world, but the rate of increase is not nearly what it was. And that's because we're reaching sort of ecological limits. We're realizing, you can't just put shrimp ponds in every mangrove river mouth, and so we're slowing down, and I think that's probably a good thing. This one just looks at, of farmed aquacultured seafood, what does the world grow? What species are the most important? And this is a worldwide graph here, and that's why the big red bar on the left is mostly coming from China, and those are the freshwater carp fish. And now we're getting to oysters, because oysters are the number two farmed seafood in the world by weight. That's millions of metric tons. And interestingly, if you look at actual species by species, the carps are divided into many species, that red graph. Whereas those oysters are mostly the Pacific or Japanese oyster, which is what I grow. And so actually, the Pacific oyster is the number one farmed seafood in the world. And then as you go down, you can see some of these other species that are grown. Okay, let's look at oysters in the U.S. Now, the United States is not the It's a pretty big oyster producer relative to other countries, but it's dwarfed by China and France. But China is number one. And what this chart shows is a breakdown by state in the United States. And it is in dollars here. And the largest sales of oysters in the U.S. is Washington, which is that second bar. And the one on the far left is Louisiana. And so that kind of, you can see the great importance of the oyster fishery in the Gulf there that's being threatened by the oil spill right now. I think that their whole fishery's been shut down. And California is coming in at about 30-something million dollars a year as the third biggest producer of by dollar value in the country. Louisiana is actually the biggest producer by tonnage of oysters, but Washington gets a higher price, higher value. California also tends to produce high-value oysters, and we are a huge market. Most of those Washington oysters, or a big, big percentage of those Washington oysters, are coming down here. And many times, if you go to a local store right here, you'll see Washington oysters. That's normally what's sold. The oysters in supermarkets and everything, they're coming. They come to L.A. first, and then they come back up to Morro Bay.
Would you lift up your mic just a little bit higher?
Oh, yes. All right, what I want to do now is look a little bit historically at California oyster culture and where they are grown. And this is an old map from the 1960, and it shows all the bays where oysters have historically been grown in California. And there are a lot of places where they've been tried and successfully for a while. Historically, the center of the oyster trade was in San Francisco, and that's where oysters were brought, were first cultured, and in the 1800s, oysters were huge. I don't know if people realize it, but nowadays, not that many people, we meet people all the time at the farmer's market that have never tried oysters. But their ancestors probably did. In the United States, oysters used to be huge. On the East Coast, in the Chesapeake Bay, they were just a staple. And people, there were oysters everywhere, and they were so plentiful that it was not a luxury item at all, but it was just a very major, major seafood. And so when American white people came out to California with a gold rush, and they wanted to eat oysters, and they went to great lengths to get oysters. They decimated the native oysters in California, and then they began bringing down native oysters from what they called Shoalwater Bay, which is now called Willapa Bay in Washington. And then they began, as soon as the Transcontinental Railroad became in place, they started shipping American oysters, which is what they grow on the East Coast and in the Gulf, out here, and they grew those in San Francisco Bay, also the American oyster. And so yesterday we heard about species introductions. And that was a major way. We now have many East Coast species because of these train loads of oysters that were brought all the way across the country, and they were plumped in San Francisco Bay. But over time, San Francisco Bay became too polluted because this has been the story of our bays and estuaries in California, that they've been given over to other more lucrative purposes, such as industry, high populations of people, Navy, and now recreational uses, so that the bays are just choked with boats, and it's much more lucrative to have marinas full of expensive yachts than to have an oyster bed. And so we've given over almost all these bays to other purposes. But today, maybe I do have a pointer. Yeah, great. Today, San Francisco is no longer, but today the biggest oyster production is up here in Humboldt Bay. Number two is Tomales Bay, north of San Francisco a little bit. And right next to Tomales Bay is Drake's Estero, which also has a very productive oyster farm. And number four, I think, is down here in... There's a lagoon in San Diego where they're producing a lot of oysters now. So that's good, right down there in Southern California. And then we are right here, and we're probably number four or five in terms of production today. Interestingly, Morro Bay was number one in the state during the World War II and shortly thereafter. Morro Bay used to be a major, major oyster-producing state bay, and you can still see the evidence of that. If you walk around the bay, you'll see the shells and that kind of thing. This shows an old map of Morro Bay and the original leases that were given for oyster culture. It was most of the bay, really. It was 1,700 acres that the Fish and Game allotted for oyster farmers in Morro Bay. And and what were they going to grow in this bay? Were there native oysters in this bay? No, there weren't. For some reason, apparently the shell, I learned from a woman yesterday that there were Indian shell middens which had native oysters. But when the Fish and Game investigated oyster culture in the 30s, they didn't find any native oysters in this bay. And so they had the big idea of going to Japan and getting this fantastic oyster from Japan and bringing it over. And they did that in 1935, and that's how the oyster industry got started. They went over to Japan, Fish and Game biologists, they brought back oysters and tried to get them to breed in the bay, but they did not reproduce. So every single year, the oyster growers had to go back to Japan and bring back these wooden crates full of little seed or spat oysters. And that's how we got all sorts of pests also that came from Japan. I have a couple Japanese oyster drills here in my pocket that I found on my farm. In those days, nobody thought about these encrusting bryozoans and things like that as being of any significance. And so they brought in all sorts of pests and exotic species. But the oyster culture flourished here for a while, but it's been through fluctuations up and down. And I have more about that in my poster out there. Today, I want to contrast this map with a photo of what the bed looks like today. This yellow line is my leases here, the northern lease and southern lease. And then there's another oyster company now that has this side of the channel. And what used to be, about 1,700 acres is down to 300 acres that is allotted for oyster culture today. These little orange spots show where we're growing oysters now. So we're actually only growing on about 2 acres here. Of the 300 acres that are allotted for oyster culture, the health department is only allowing oyster culture on about something like 60, only about 60 acres. Of the 300. So we're very, very constricted as to what historically had been allotted for oyster culture. Now I want to look at a little bit about how we grow them. This was a foggy day. We were out there planting seed. These are baby oysters, Pacific Japanese oysters, but they don't come from Japan anymore. They're coming from a hatchery in Washington. They're very clean, at least to the naked eye. They don't have any pests or any species of that we might introduce. And they're being put into these protective mesh bags. These are some kayakers that got lost in the fog that day, and they came over to us to ask us which was the way back to the marina. This is the newest little section of the northern bed that I started. I planted this summer. You can see these rows of mesh bags. These are stuck to the bottom. They're not floating. And when the tide comes in, they disappear so you don't see them. Sometimes motorboats go right over them and tear them up with their props. I need to mark them, but I don't want it so obvious that it's a big sign saying, hey, here, come get my oysters. But, oops, I hit the wrong button here. And this is our southern bed. We're taking the seed that now has grown to a couple inches long and putting it in the larger mesh bags, and then laying these on the mud, actually attaching them to the mud flap. And then after about a total of about 8 months, the bags kind of fill up with these, you know, oysters that are about 3 inches long. Let's see if I have a picture of one. Yeah, and these are young oysters. They've been handled quite a bit, and they get a nice shape and kind of pretty appearance. And we're trying to kind of grow a real gourmet, beautiful oyster. And the seafood watch organizations kind of rate seafoods and about whether you can feel good about buying one type of seafood versus another. And they put the oysters on what they call a super green list because not only is it environmentally benign relative to other forms of seafood, but also nutritionally really good for you with the omega-3 fatty acids. So it gets a very high rating from that group. And this is what we're going to be serving today at the farmer's market here in Morro Bay at 3 p.m. A little plug there. And I want to try to make, this is a way to make oysters really palatable and popular with just about anybody. You broil them and put a little garlic butter on them, and then, oops, not again. Okay. There we go. And then broil it with some breadcrumbs and Parmesan cheese and some spices. Very good. And so, but I want to talk about some of the more serious environmental issues regarding oysters. There are some potential negatives about growing oysters. And we heard earlier about debris in the bay or in the ocean. And we're using those plastic mesh bags to grow the oysters in, and they can get loose. And we've had a problem with a lot of them getting loose in the bay. And we're working on that. All those bags that get loose are floating bags almost entirely. They have floats on them to keep them so they come up with the tide. And that puts them under tremendous forces when there's a strong wind and waves out there, and they get ripped. They can get ripped off of their long lines and end up floating all over the place. I have ended all floating culture. All my oysters are down on the bottom, and so that is greatly reduced losses. And we still, and so I think that's helping. And the non-native introductions, first of all, the Japanese oyster itself is a non-native species, and so that's been a concern. There are some bays where they definitely do not want Japanese or Pacific, we call them Japanese or Pacific oysters, in their bay. For instance, the Chesapeake Bay has Native American oysters that are very threatened. They're trying to revive the huge fishery that used to be in the Chesapeake. One idea is, well, let's introduce Pacific oysters. They're very hardy, but that would probably be the death knell to the American oysters on the Chesapeake, so they want to keep them out of there. In our bay, the Pacific oysters don't reproduce. If you look in the fowling communities or on pilings and try to find wild set Pacific oysters, we can't find them. Nobody's found them. They do not reproduce, as far as we know, ever. And whereas if you go down to San Diego Bay and you poke around on the rocks, you'll see Pacific oysters all over the place there. So I'm not sure where I was going with that, but we historically, as I said before, there were a lot of non-native introductions by bringing seed in from Japan. And now that we're getting the seed from the hatcheries, it's much cleaner, and it's much less of an issue. Thirdly, let's look the issue of the visual effects of the oyster beds. If you live right on the bay and you look out, you know, you'll see the oyster barges, the floating structures, and they're, you know, they're kind of an eyesore sometimes, I think. So that's something that we need to try to minimize. The maybe what I'm doing is storing less stuff on my barge out there in the middle of the bay, so that it's not a big old hulky thing loaded with oyster bags, but it's more of a work platform. It's not so obvious of a big blot on the bay. And then finally, eelgrass. We share a very similar habitat to the eelgrass habitat there. And let me go back a couple slides here. Now this is the we stretch out the oysters at about a positive 1 foot or 1.5 foot tidal level, and it tends to be above the eelgrass. Sometimes there will be a few plants here and there nearby, but I call my farm Grassy Bar because these bars of mud are fringed with seagrasses. There's eelgrass nearby, but we have to stay out of the eelgrass, and that really limits where we can grow oysters because there's so much eelgrass out there. Now I want to talk a little bit, end up with some positive things. The most of the seafood that Americans like to eat are carnivores, but oysters, anchovies, smelt, things like that are herbivorous animals, and they're not as popular with Americans, but oysters can be extremely delicious, and it can be a way to get people to eat low on the food chain. And that's really, really important for the health of the oceans, and not to be taking and eating these top carnivores that are rare and depend on a large base of other animals below them in the food chain. Our local oyster culture methods don't use any kind of feed or drugs or pesticides. And that's pretty much the case with oyster farming everywhere, except for there is one exception up in Willapa Bay. They actually do aerial spraying with carbaryl pesticide, which is, I think, 7-dest. At low tide, they actually spray the mud flats only once, about once every 3 years. before there are oysters, they'll go out and spray the mudflats, and it kills the mudworms and the ghost shrimp and mud shrimp, which make the mud soft, and they have to kill those mud shrimp and ghost shrimp to make so that the mud will be firm enough to plant oysters on. And they are being forced to stop that practice. And I think in 2012 is the last year that they'll be able to use that, and they're trying to find some other way to control the mud shrimp. But here in California, we've never used any of those methods. And so we're proud of that our local oysters are totally pesticide, herbicide, that kind of thing, free. And since we're growing them, historically, in those old oyster beds I showed you, the oysters were grown just out in the open, just laying on the mud, and or maybe up off the mud a little bit. And they're exposed to predators. And so the farmers were always really concerned about predators. And they would maybe kill crabs and if there were skates and rays in there, they might kill those. But now that we're growing them inside those mesh bags, predation is really not an issue at all. So we don't have to do any depredation of predators. But really the big environmental thing about oysters is that we're so dependent on extremely clean water. And being out there, it's like we're kind of like the canary in the coal mine. If we go under, it's probably because the bay just wasn't clean enough. And we're very, very highly regulated by the health department because oysters are filter feeders. They will pick up pathogens from human fecal matter and that kind of thing. And so we have to be extremely careful and err on the side of caution to make sure our products are really safe. And so that makes us just so vulnerable. We're at the very bottom of the estuary. We're downstream from everybody. And we're at everybody's mercy, basically, that they would be careful to keep the bay clean. And so that's why I'm so proud to be part of this organization and want to encourage it. And how can, what are some ways that we oyster farmers can build community support and get more interest in having a clean bay? And this second thing, small-scale shellfish gardening, is an idea that's pretty exciting. It's something that's being done in Washington State a lot. And the idea is that you get regular people, rather than being just commercial shellfish growing, you get your own little plot out there. In Washington, people live all along the sound, along Puget Sound, and so many people have their own backyard with a mud flat right there, or a little sandy beach, and they can grow some shellfish right in their own backyard. And here, there are a few opportunities on Morro Bay for some people like that, but most of us don't live right on the bay. But there's a lot of acreage. You know, we're only using a couple acres, and I would be willing to set aside, if we can work out the legalities of it and everything, a little community plot where people could have a few thousand, enough oysters or you could grow clams or mussels and just get into having your own shellfish garden. And that what that does, it causes a buy-in. Everybody all of a sudden really wants to have clean water. They want their garden to be full of really healthy, good seafood. So that's something I'm thinking about and working on. And maritime employment, as the oyster industry revives, which is what I'm hoping it will, it creates kind of old style fishing type jobs. So it brings something to the community other than just tourism. We've got a local product, we've got something this community's proud of and can be known for and can create employment with maritime type of employment. And so so I'm really, really optimistic about it. It's going to be a battle to keep fighting for clean water and doing the oyster farming in a way that is brings the community in and is environmentally sound. So thank you very much.
So if you guys have any questions for him, we can take a few minutes. Lexi will run mics around and just raise your hand.
It was a great presentation. I'd like to say, too, that another I work with the Estuary Program as a volunteer. And I'm very proud to work for Ann and Annie because I like oysters. I'll sit there at dockside, outside there, eating oysters with a nice glass of beer. But I was concerned about the estuary and how clean it was. Well, they had a program they started about 10 years ago. And since I'm a kind of a high-tech person from the space industry, we take samples of the water once a month. We run it through our microscopes. We have a lab there at the Estuary Program. And it's clean, really clean. I was really, really impressed with how clean the estuary is because that water that comes at the North Bay, where we the North Pier, eventually gets down to your end. So I'm satisfied that when I eat your oysters, they're good oysters, and I'm not going to get sick or die from it. Also... Also, I like to say that I belong to the Historical Society. We just finished up a book. I've been trying to get a hold of you personally, but you've been pretty busy. That back in the 1920s, we're doing this new book, Then and Now. And then, like you said, they had these oysters in this muck, in the mud. They used to pull these right out of the mud, which take a long time, I guess, to get all that stuff out of the oysters. And then we put your picture in there of today, of the modern way that you do it. But anyway, thank you, and keep those oysters coming.
A question on oysters. I understand that now you determine whether or not the oysters are safe by this periodic analysis of the water and no longer depend on the old adage that you don't eat oysters in any month with an R in it.
That's right.
Is so we can ignore the R's from now on?
Could you, those panelists,
okay, there we go. Yeah, the old adage about not eating oysters in months that do not have R's comes from the paralytic shellfish poisoning, which comes from biotoxins like domoic acid and from these plankton blooms. And you'll still see that recently the quarantine signs went up around the bay saying don't eat the clams and mussels. And that goes from May 1st through all those months that don't have R's, and then it includes September, includes a couple months with R's. So there is a little bit of truth to that, in that those summer, fall months are the ones that have the highest risk of having biotoxins. But when you're a farmer, you have to sample your product and have it analyzed every single week of the year. And it's kept, we keep tabs, and the health department keeps tabs on the biotoxin activity. And it doesn't, and so we know that they're safe and we can sell them all summer long unless there is some activity and then we have to shut them down. So that's how it works today.
I was wondering if you have more than a Pseudonychia that you're worried about in your oysters. So the clams are that way. And I was wondering if the oysters are more sensitive or not. Probably the same filter feeder, but I don't know.
The clams versus oysters?
Yeah,
The Pseudonychia is what causes, what has domoic acid in it. And that's one concern. And then the other one are the dinoflagellates like Alexandrium that make the paralytic shellfish poison. So those are two concerns. As far as clams go, I don't know. I don't know how they compare in terms of how fast they pick up the biotoxins. I know the large clams, they say, don't eat the digestive part of the, you know, just eat the white meat, and that protects you quite a bit from those toxins. Whereas with the oyster, you're eating the whole thing. So you have to make sure that they're free of those, of that, those algae.
I'd like to expand on that a little bit, too, because that's one of the things we look for, the pseudonuchia, when we do our examples and we look under the microscope. Mm-hmm. And it was a couple years ago, we had a horrible bloom. Man, all of a sudden it exploded. And so we contact, I think it's in Oakland, who we contact, mm-hmm. and they say, we got an explosion right now. And I'm glad you called, because they call up and down the whole state of California in the southern part, that is pseudonuchia outbreak. And it was recently after that, there was a couple sea otters that died. And they think that was related to the pseudonuchia. So there's some good programs going on here in the estuary program. Yeah.
Right. I think it's been a pretty successful. No one has ever gotten sick from the domoic acid in California or even on the west coast of the U.S. ever. According to the health department, there probably may have been some cases that weren't reported or something, but so it's been a successful program.
Hi, I had a question actually for each of you. I'll just give it all at once. Kara, where could we buy your product? Retail, and George, the same, besides the program this afternoon where you're going to have barbecued oysters, where can we buy it retail? And Robert, where are you a chef?
You guys go.
I'm currently the chef at Manson Marsh. It's an elderly retirement home, but that's only for another week. and then I'm off to Cal Poly.
And you can purchase my products at Spencer's Market in Morro Bay, Sunshine Health Food Market in Morro Bay, Nature's Touch in Templeton, and New Frontiers in San Luis, and the Natural Food Co-op. And then I'm also in two different CSA boxes, one of which is called Slow Veg, which is delivering to Los Osos, and I believe we'll start delivering to Morro Bay soon. And they deliver all locally pesticide-free vegetables, fruits, and nuts once a week or every other week to your door. And then Nature's Touch in Templeton also does a CSA box, and I'm in their boxes as well.
I'm just getting started, so I don't have a good local outlets yet for my oysters, but I have the farmer's market here, and then if you call me, I'll meet you down at my boat and get them right off the boat.
Yeah, I wanted to thank all three of you for your presentations and also for your commitment to this small as beautiful efforts that you're making. And George Trevelyan, I wanted to ask you on these oysters. Apparently there was a native oyster in Morro Bay, and is there any possibility of reintroducing that or getting it from, or does it exist in another area in California? Or?
Yes, it does. And you can sometimes buy the baby native oysters from hatcheries. They're usually not available, but it's possible to get them and then be able to plant them in this bay again. I just heard yesterday from somebody, one of the presenters, she said that from her reading, there were native oyster shells in the native shell kitchen middens, indicating at one time, a long time ago, there were. But as far as biologists say, in the early, you know, history, 1800s, and that time, no one's ever seen them in this bay. So it's been a long time since they've been here, I guess. So, But yes, they can be brought, they could be brought in and grown here. Pardon?
Could you do that?
Yeah, I could probably do that if I can get some from the hatchery. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd be interested in doing that.
Well, that pretty much runs us a little past time. So is there any other burning questions anybody really needs to ask? All right. This is a horn shark that was out in the eelgrass beds on one of the very low tides. Yeah, it was. I didn't see it. I think it was about 3-4 feet long. Pretty big creature. So on that note, thank you all for coming. I encourage you. Yeah, thank the panel. I want to encourage everybody, if you haven't seen the posters on the other side of the expandable wall, to go take a look at them. There's a lot of good information over there. If you haven't signed up for a field trip, they're going to be departing 45 minutes to an hour from now. We have some great field trips. They're all up at the front desk. You can find out about it. And thank you again.